5 after 9, we need to start this meeting. We welcome you to our Wildlife Board. We've got a long agenda today, a big one. We're going to try to keep things under control and get out of here at a decent hour if we can. Let me introduce the board. To the far left, Jake Albrecht from the southern region. Next to him, Bill Fenimore from the northern region. Calvin Crandall from the central region. Ernie Perkins from the northern region. Myself, Del Brady from the northeast region. To my right, Director Jim Karpowitz. Next, we have John Baer from the central region and Mike King from the southeast region. We also recognize we have Stacy helping us and Judy. Oh, Luann Petrovich. From our RAC, we have Robert Byrne from the northern region. Floyd Briggs from the northeast region. Fred Oswald from the central region. We have Steve Flinders from the southern region. And I guess we got Darius Jones on his way from the southeast region. As far as on the agenda items, ...12 to 13 action items that's got to be discussed. It's going to take some time. We have in other business, we have three different things, well, two different things. Mike King, you're prepared for the WAFWA, a little bit of a presentation. Stacy, you gave me one other that we needed to talk about.
Stipulations and orders from Marty Bushman.
Oh, yes. Stipulations and orders from Marty Bushman, our legal counsel. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have a closed section where the board will make selections for awards on nomination for some awards to be given out in September. Don, when I see in the audience, you might have traveled further than anybody to get here. From Norman Wells. All the way. Okay.
Del?
Yes.
I might make a suggestion. Some of that stuff you listed under other business, like the WAFWA report, maybe we could handle that at lunch so that we don't extend the board meeting any longer. And there's also one other item that we need to discuss under other business, and that's we'll get into this as we go through the agenda today. We may need an emergency meeting in September, and I think we ought to set a date while we're all here to deal with drought-related issues.
Okay. We'll do that. Mike, maybe we can. That's a good idea if we can take that WAFWA during our lunch break.
It'll be brief.
Be short and sweet.
If there's no objection, we could do the award selection over lunchtime too, just stepping in.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. We'll do as much as we can during there. Okay, with those items added to the agenda. Right. Let me ask, are there individuals here representing the Houndsman? And if there are, if you'll raise your hand. see three hands in the air? We, as a board, and probably the RAC, have received significant input, emails, and whatever, regarding Houndsman and Cougar take. That item, well, let me start over. In the RAC meetings, five of the seven board members heard those presentations and discussions. All of the board members have read the emails that we've received from that. And the division has heard the concerns and recommendations of the Houndsman and has already agreed to consider them in the upcoming three-year review. One concern raised by the Houndsman warrants priority review, and that is, and that's regarding the alleged female overharvest of cougars. So as chairman of the board, I'm asking the division to just do an expeditious review of the data and to provide the board members their analysis and conclusions. At that point, board members can contact myself if they think further actions are warranted. And my question to the board, are you satisfied with that? This is not an agenda item. I don't want to present it as an agenda item.
Yeah, what it sounds to me is like is an action log item, and I think that's probably where we should have brought it up. Okay. But if that's an action log item, if the board wants to add that to the action log, that's fine.
I think that's a good idea.
Mr. Chairman, I need to speak on this for just a quick minute. I know we're pressed for time. I think it was a mistake not having this on the agenda. I think that the Houndsman made a good faith effort to go to all the meetings, present their case, and I know we're busy, but this is a biological issue. There's other things that have been put on the agenda that are not biological issues that we're going to deal with today that are, you know, that I think if that warrants discussion, I can't imagine how the lion thing's going to be passed over. So, you know, whether we take action on today or not is not just up to me, but I think definitely, you know, whether it's in the middle of a plan or not, I think in the future when, you know, when a group like this shows up to all the RAC meetings and whatnot, I think they deserve to be heard here. So that's just my opinion.
I appreciate that, John. Normally this month we frequently do have the Cougar information, but because we're in the middle of that three-year plan, it's not this year. But with our board's approval, we'll put it on an action item, and I would anticipate Director Karpowicz that that's going to be responded to quickly. Not like
well
time period.
Yeah, as quick as you'd like, but the likelihood of affecting changes for this year without going clear back through the process is not likely.
That's right, and I agree with that. I agree with that. So the board's okay with that?
Do you need that in the form of a motion for an action log?
Have that in the form of a motion. Put it on the action
log. I would move that we put the Cougar comments, the Cougar information that came before all the RACs on an action log item with to have the division look at that sooner than later.
Well, I think you better clarify what you want.
Let me read this again.
Dell read something that sounded just like an action log item.
Yeah. So I and the board asking the division, the DWR, to do an expeditious review of the data and to provide the board members their analysis and conclusions and recommendations as soon as possible.
So moved.
All in favor?
Second.
Ernie seconded that. And all in favor? All opposed? Four in favor, two against? John and Jake.
Jake.
Okay. So, with that, we're going to move on to approval of the agenda.
I'll move that we accept the agenda as amended, adding the stipulations discussion under other business.
Okay.
Second.
As well as this possible emergency September meeting?
Yes. Pardon me.
Okay. Moved by Ernie, seconded by Jake. All in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. All right. Approval of the minutes of our June meeting's minutes. Do we have any changes that need to be made?
I just want to make a comment. After I got Ernie's email, I went through and printed the minutes so I could go through them and make sure that they were as good as what Ernie commented, rather than reading on the iPad. But I want to comment the ladies for the minutes. I couldn't find another mistake in there, so be it.
Okay.
I'll make a motion we approve the minutes.
Second.
As corrected by Ernie.
Yeah, subject to the corrections of Ernie. Motion made, seconded by Calvin. All in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. Okay. Old business or action log. Ernie, Vice Chair.
Yeah, we have no items that are due to come out today. I do have one request for the board. The first action log item has got a target date of fall 2012, and that is asking the division to give a presentation on the current preference point system for general season deer units and how far down you can be in your choices and still get a preference point award. If we don't hear that this coming November, it will then be another year before any change desired by the board could take effect. It's got to go through the RACs and the board. So I would propose and ask that instead of asking the division to come back to us at a presentation from this point forward, we just ask the division to take that out as part of the November RAC and December board round, showing the RACs the advantages and disadvantages of the current preference system and one or two options.
Any comments?
That's what we planned on doing with the target date of fall 2012. We'll incorporate it in our our proposals for November.
Okay. Anything else?
That's got the action log then.
Okay, Director Karpowitz, any update?
In the interest of time, I'm only going to talk about one topic and then answer any questions that the board might have. As everybody is painfully aware, we're in the middle of one of the worst droughts in the history of Utah. I don't think in my 35-year career I've seen the drought so widespread and so intense in certain parts of the state. Also one of the worst fire years on record. We've now burned about 500,000 acres in Utah, some of it very important big game winter range, some of it summer range. A lot of these fires occurred early in the year. We could still burn several hundred thousand acres yet this year. Mike Styler gave a report to the legislature this week on the financial impact of what that means. It's huge, not only in cost of fighting the fires, but now going back and rehabilitating all those ranges. We've also had to, you've probably seen the emergency orders I've signed, a number of them for fishing actions, either eliminating the limit or raising the limit to allow people to take fish out of waters that are rapidly being dewatered. Now, in regards to fire rehabilitation. Let me just say this. Utah is in a better position to address that than any other state in the West. Because of our watershed initiative and our habitat improvement programs that are in place, we are ready and anxious to get about the work of fire rehab. We have $5 million worth of seed that's been delivered to our warehouse this week. We have the people, we have the equipment, we have the expertise to know how to get this done. And it's really comforting to me that over the past several years, we have put into place a process and a program where we can go about this very rapidly. I can tell you this does not exist in other states. This program does not exist in other wildlife agencies. And the Watershed Initiative and UPCD, the Utah Partners for Conservation and Development, and the process we have in place, we can react very quickly to a situation like this, and we are ready to go on fire rehab. As soon as the cooler weather gets here, we'll start putting this seed on the ground. Some of these fires have actually proved beneficial for wildlife. I saw pictures this last week of the Sealy Fire on the north end of the Manti. There's already aspen sprouts 3 to 4 feet high on a lot of that burn, and some of those elk are going to think they died and went to heaven. So it's really, some of it is positive, but there's a lot of it that's pretty scary. So what I want to mention is that later in the agenda today, we're going to talk about the need for additional antlerless permits. We have a lot of winter ranges that are in about as bad a condition as I've ever seen, and a lot of animals poised to move early to those ranges that are probably going to be in poor condition. So we're going to ask for additional antlerless removal. We're also going to be watching the winter conditions real carefully to see if we need to initiate some winter feeding. Fortunately, we've received quite a bit of rain in southern and southeastern Utah, and we've seen quite a bit improvement in our winter ranges in the last few weeks. But we are running out of time. After September 1st, the rain's not going to do much good. There's not going to be enough time for anything to grow yet this growing season. So I just want you to know that the division's on top of this. We're watching it very closely. We're very concerned. And we've been working on this pretty extensively for quite a long time this summer. So that's the only thing I wanted to update the board on. We're betting a little bit on the come. We've bought the seed, and we're going to put it in the ground without an appropriation. We're going to have to go to the legislature and make sure that that money is returned to us and that we don't exceed our appropriation. But I'm willing to take that risk, and I'm confident that the legislature will come through and appropriate that money so we can get it done. Any questions from the board about the drought or anything else?
Which reservoirs or fishing waters have you done some of those on? Just not a list of all of them, but just...
You know, I couldn't even list them all. I've done about a dozen where we've either raised the limit or done away with the limit. The most recent one we did, Echo. Somebody's going to have to help me with that. Is there anybody that knows what all of the waters are that we've signed emergency orders on?
Did Ken's Lake.
There's about a dozen of them. Stacy probably has them. We'll get that to you at lunch. But there's a bunch of them that are being dewatered. Waters where we either don't have conservation permit or conservation pools. I have conservation permits on my brain. Or streams that are being completely dewatered. We've also lost some fisheries. We lost one of our best blue ribbon fisheries this year, Huntington Creek. After the fire, we got some intense thunder showers, and it sent all that silt down the stream and killed all the fish. Also killed fish over in the Mud Creek drainage. So there's lots of impacts with these fires. for both fish and wildlife, and it's pretty scary. We're almost in a no-win situation. If we get a hard winter, we're in trouble, and if we don't, we're in trouble. So we're in trouble either way. There's going to be losses to wildlife and fish. You just can't have this intense of a drought situation and not have significant impacts.
Any other questions? Director Wirtz? If not, we have at 9:30 a board variance to hear. Stacy, are we ready?
Yes, sir.
Judy?
Yeah, let me check and see if Brad Miller is. Brad Miller, are you here? Okay, if you can come up to this mic right here, we can present his variance. We just have one variance request today. Judy Tutter, a licensing coordinator out of the Salt Lake office. We have Brad Miller has a limited entry bear on the Central Mounds Manti North, and we presented his variance through the Division Variance Committee. And Brad Miller was, he accessed the hunt unit on April the 7th and began placing and managing bait sites. On May 26th, he was diagnosed with an illness that prevented him from completing his hunt. Because he did access the unit and did do some hunting and had opportunity, the committee's recommendation would be is to deny this request, and Brad's here now to present his request in person to the board. Go ahead. State your name, please.
Brad Miller. With my bear permit, it was... I set up the camera, set up my bait. Nothing ever came in until after I was hospitalized. I sent my son and son-in-law down to check the cameras, and they came back and said the bear was there, and I had basically 2 days left in the hunt at that point. But because of the illness, then I couldn't pull the bow back or anything else. So I know I was in the field, but I never took my bow because there was no tracks in the snow. There was no bears hitting the bait or anything else. So while I was in the field, it was basically scouting and managing the bait during that time.
Any questions from the board?
So you never sat in your tree stand armed and ready to kill? Or
I set the tree stands up, never got into them, never sat in them because there was no bears coming in.
Do you feel like you hunted at all?
I did not. I didn't have my bow with me at any time during that time.
And so you had an archery only
correct
permit. You never took your bow with you in the field?
No. Any other comments or questions from the board?
Go ahead.
All right, here, John.
Just remind me. What does a bear permit qualify for? Is bonus points back? And
it can be an extension of the season, or it can be the bonus points in the waiting period removed, either or.
What are you asking for?
If I could do just bonus points and then draw the permit later on so I don't have to start from ground zero.
We restored your bonus points and waive your waiting period. That would
be great.
Ernie?
Just ask, how far do you live from the hunting unit?
I live in Lehigh. I was driving down there once or twice a week to check baits, getting stuck in the snow, trying to find where the bears were at, but it was quite a few trips down there.
Thank you.
Okay. No other questions?
I know this is kind of where the board's opinion comes in, and it's hard to come up with that a lot of times on these. I would say if you'd carried your bow with you, if you were armed and could have saw a bear and shot it, I would say you'd have hunted. And that would, in my opinion, disqualify you. But where he didn't have his weapon with him, I guess what he... In my mind, what he was doing and the activity he engaged in would equate to scouting, which is, I mean, if he didn't have his bow, he couldn't have killed anything. I think he wasn't hunting, so I would be inclined to give him his bonus points back and waive his waiting period. I'd be interested to know what the rest of you think.
Put it in the form of a motion. We'll find out.
I would make the motion that we reinstate Mr. Miller's bonus points and waive his waiting period so that he can continue putting in for his hunt and next year.
We have a second? Motion made by John, seconded by Mike King. All in favor, well, let's restate the motion. That we're restating the motion was that they could restore his bonus points.
Waive
the waiting period. All in favor?
Well, let's talk about it for just a second.
Okay, good.
We had this discussion here just, last meeting or two meetings ago, and this is one of those gray areas that we talked about and we knew would come up when we said, and I guess the new...
The new variance rule will not go into place until August the 21st. We're still under the old variance.
So this goes under the old... Usually people like to ignore what I say, so I guess this just brings up that point again about these gray areas and what constitutes hunting and what doesn't, and I hope that the new rules help us clarify some of that. But even that, if there's a day in the field, what did the new one say if we have a day in the field?
The new variance rule, the hunt day, means spending any time in the field hunting the permitted animal species in a single day during lawful hunting hours. That's what the new rule will be
but
under.
But we don't define hunting anywhere, is that?
Not in the current rule, correct. No, we do not.
Or in the one in the future.
Well, that's as close as we're getting to it, is the hunt day.
So still a little bit ambiguous about what hunting is.
It is a gray area. I'll agree with that. It's definitely a gray area. Like I said, where I draw my conclusion for the motion is he didn't have a weapon with him. And if he would have had a weapon, my mind, that's spot and stalk hunting, which is hunting which would disqualify him. And I know it's a gray area, but we have to make some kind of a decision, and that's kind of my feelings on it. So.
I got a question for you. How long is the hunt? When does it start? When does it stop?
It starts in April and ends first week in June.
So it's roughly a 60-day. Well, maybe not. Starts in 1st of April, mid-April.
Mid-April.
Mid-April,
like
so it's roughly 45 days. How long did you have your bait set at? You start baiting when the season starts. You can't start before.
Right. I started as soon as the season started and then just went down and kept checking.
For how long? 2 weeks, 3 weeks?
Right up until I went in the hospital, which was the last week in May. So I had done it all.
So basically a month and a half.
All of
the
April
half,
and basically all,
half
all of
a month
May.
Of April and then most of May you were checking, baiting, checking, and nothing ever came into your
nothing
bait traps.
Nothing ever came in. All the snow and everything else. No tracks in the snow. No... Nothing hitting the bait.
There was still snow because it was a late spring.
Correct.
And then after you were diagnosed, that's when he started coming in.
Right. When my son went down and checked the cameras and
based on the cameras, that's when they started coming in.
That's when they started coming in.
I like your comment. Say, go figure, huh? Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Just make a comment. It's been stated, this one's really gray for me. The follow-on that we're going to get to this one is somebody who has a I just decided I wanted to go on days 14. That wasn't close enough? Okay. Pardon me. So, basically, there's going to be a follow-on to this line, and I think we all need to be aware of that.
I'm really not voting unless we have a tie, but I'll just express an opinion. I can see John's position that there was no hunting, actual hunting with a weapon being carried, and I'm almost in favor of going that way. But on the same hand, do we choose the last week? Like if you're going deer hunting, sometimes the last week is the best time after everybody's gone home, you know. It's a very difficult decision for the board to make. We have no agenda other than trying to keep things fair and square, and that we have all types of these come before us, and sometimes it's hard to believe what we do have come before us. But we do need to make a decision and move on. I asked the board, motion has been made, the motion has been seconded. Call for a vote. All in favor of the motion to restore the bonus points and waive the waiting period, if you will. All in favor, raise your hand. Three, four, all opposed. Three against. Early in the day. But I got to put up or shut up. I vote in favor of it. Thank you.
Okay. I'd just like to make a comment. I think we need to maybe try and evaluate the definition of hunting a little bit more. Like we've talked about already, is it carrying a weapon or is it spending time during the season out trying to figure out where one is? Hard to vote against something when the definition's not very clear.
I agree with Dr. King that is a very gray area that somehow we need to look to clarify for future things. But
we ought to put that on the action log for our legal counsel. Well,
Does Marty have an opinion on that?
We can have Marty come up and talk to it because we've taken this rule out and we have defined some better areas, and so we think these variances will go smoother in the future. But.
Marty Bushman, Utah Attorney General's Office. Hunting is defined. It's defined in the Utah Code, and it's defined to mean to take or pursue an animal. Take means it's also defined in code to hunt, pursue, chase, capture, kill, injure, same. Yeah, a number of others, but the two operative words are take or pursue. That's what hunting means.
What does pursue, how's that defined?
Pursue is not defined. You'd have to go to Webster's.
Same thing. So is baiting pursuing?
I suppose it could be if you wanted to read the definition. I mean, you're at that point, you are engaged in trying to take a bear. You may not have been successful yet, but
am I pursuing?
Like, are you pursuing angling if you got your bait in the water, but although you've never got a bite yet?
Am I pursuing birds at my bird feeder when I put bird seed out to feed winter birds?
Hopefully, you're not shooting them.
Well, I'm not shooting them if I'm baiting a bear either.
Yeah, well,
so
I mean that's
my concern. Those.
Mm-hmm. The difference, the operative difference there is one is you're baiting to try to draw an animal in to take it. You are drawing animals in to observe them. So yours isn't even a regulated activity.
Are you saying we need to just decide whether it's pursuing or not to bait and then live with it? We need to make that decision.
Question is what the definition of hunting is. I mean, it'll be up for you to decide what pursuit is and whether, you know, what Mr. Miller engaged in here constitutes pursuit.
All those words and you didn't help us a bit, Marty.
I gave you a new term to consider at least.
Thank you, Marty.
Okay,
Brad. Looks like you got your points back and your waiting period waived. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Next item, by the way, welcome, Bill. Taking over for the Southeast region, Bill Bates. Next item on the agenda is the bobcat harvest recommendation. John, if you want to make your presentation.
Take a second while this comes up. Okay, good morning, everyone. This should go fairly quickly. We'll keep things moving along. The Bobcat plan is fairly simple and straightforward in terms of the numbers and the way we calculate permits and things, so we should be able to get through this. And I'll just give you a short, really little background on it, and then talk about what our recommendations are going to be. The performance targets are these four variables on the right. These are characteristics of the bobcat population that we're monitoring. That is the proportion of kittens and yearlings that are taken, the adult survival rate, which is what we calculate. The says percent is basically the proportion of females that have been harvested, and then the set days per bobcat. And we get the set days per bobcat by surveying our fur bearer, or licensed fur bearer folks. So set days per bobcat, essentially, if you set 100 traps for 100 days and you catch, you know, that's 1,000 set days, and however many bobcats you would catch during that time is how that calculation's done. We have target ranges, which are essentially the confidence intervals around a historic average going back to the 80s or so. So we know what we've been, what we've seen over the years, and we want to keep it right in that range. That keeps it more or less stable. So we adjust accordingly. Our performance targets for the 2012, kittens and yearlings, 0.35, adult survival, 0.7, females, 0.45, and that set days for bobcat came in at about 400, or at 400. And as you remember, to put it up comparing to the targets variables or target ranges, the kittens and yearlings was a little lower than we'd wanted to, and set days per bobcat was higher than we had wanted to. And so we have got two variables that are out of range. The plan is fairly straightforward on to handle this sort of thing. That is, if any two performance targets are outside of the range, we would adjust the number of tags per individual by 1 to 2. And however, there's a great little bit of language that was added last year, and that is to keep the number of tags consistent with the previous year if the variables are moving towards target ranges. So we need to consider the year before as well. So if we look at 2011 and 2012 relative to the target ranges, the kittens and yearlings was lower in 11, but it's moved up towards where it's supposed to be. Survival and females are stayed in ranges both years, and the set days per bobcat is moving closer to where our target is, where we want it to be. So that being said, it looks like the management we had last year is moving everything in the right direction, and so it's probably best to stay the course according to the plan. Therefore, our recommendations are going to be consistency with the previous year. That is, if you were to pull up the recommended guidebook that we're working on now, it'll look just like the last year's guidebook, except that there'll be some just adjusting the dates so they don't, you know, fall on a Sunday, for instance. That is the maximum number of permits, 4,600, limit of 3 permits per individual, and the season essentially the same as last year, November 28th to February 3rd. There's their straightforward recommendations.
Any questions from the board?
So you have 4,600 permits that are available. Do all those get taken?
Out of all of those, I don't think we fill... Yeah, we all of them. Yeah.
Those are all taken. So those permits are all sold or taken then.
Yes.
Okay.
And they would yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're not all harvested, but they're all taken. And that maximum of 3 per person.
Yes.
Other questions from the board? Ernie?
I'll make a motion that we accept the bobcat recommendations.
How to go to the racks.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
I want to go with Ernie.
We're just trying to move this thing along, guys. We'll still be here till late tonight. So I excuse Ernie. Steve, let me start with you then.
We passed the motion unanimously as presented.
Bill from the Southeast region.
We had two motions. The first one was to reduce the number of bobcat tags by 1 to 2 permits per person. That failed 5-1, and then we had another motion to accept the bobcat harvest recommendations as presented, and that passed 5-1.
Okay. Brad Oswald from the Central region.
Mr. Chairman, the Central RAC unanimously approved their division's recommendations.
Thank you. Floyd?
As the Northeastern RAC did, too. We passed it unanimously.
Robert from the Northern region.
Mr. Chairman, the Northern region recommended the Wildlife Board accept the bobcat harvest recommendations as presented and passed unanimously.
Thank you. Do we have any questions, not comments, but questions from the audience? No question?
Ask question.
Yes, go ahead.
Bill, did you have a quorum at your Southeastern region?
We had 7 of 14.
Okay.
Stacy can tell us if that's a quorum or not. Did not. But I guess ours is just advisory.
Okay. You got a question. State your name.
Jason Adamson. I've got a question that when your days in the field are 400 and your target is 197, so you're doubled and you're off on two of the points, also your kittens coming into it, how do you not reduce it? You're double on one of those stats. Not just a little over, you're double. Question.
Fair question. John, do you want to answer that?
That is a good question, and I didn't put on that presentation. The range actually on set days per bobcat is 171 to 220. And the other good, excellent point about that is that any one of those variables, especially the set days per bobcat variable, has is really impacted by the number of people in the field, the number of new people in the field, which, if you look at the numbers, is very much explained by what last year's pelt price was. So if you have a high pelt price, then you have a lot of new people come in the next year that aren't as familiar with what is familiar with what they're doing, and then it changes that number quite a bit. But that's why we don't rely on any just one metric in order to put this together. That's why we have those four up there, so we can look at them all simultaneously and see which ones are moving in the right directions and which ones are continuing to move in the right direction, but not any one of them has all of the weight. So that's how we calculate it and come up with it. It's a good plan that way.
Okay, thank you. Comments from the audience. I have no comment card.
One last question. John, when that plan was adopted, were those standards and performance standards, those were agreed upon, fully supported by the trappers and the houndsmen, is that correct?
Well, the trappers and houndsmen, they're all part of the committee putting together the plan. Yeah, I wasn't privy to the conversations and, you know, who put it together, but it went through and passed, and it is what it is.
I don't remember that there was much contention there. I thought it was pretty widely supported, if not unanimously.
So
we had members of the Trappers Association, Houndsman representative. They're all on the committee putting it together.
Okay. Thank you, John. Board discussion. Means we're ready for a motion. Board motion.
Pardon my previous jumping the gun. Okay, I recommend we accept the harvest recommendations of the division for the coming year.
Have a second. Seconded by Mike King. All in favor? Unanimous? Thank you. Next on our agenda is the Waterfowl Guidebook and Rule, Blair Stringham.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Tonight, this morning, I'll be presenting the waterfowl recommendations for the 2012-2013 season. And briefly, I just wanted to give you an update on two of the important surveys that we follow each year, which gives us the direction we go as far as our regulations each year. First one of those is a habitat survey, and basically it's a measure of the May pond count in the prairie pottle regions of the United States and Canada. And it informs us as to the conditions for breeding birds that coming year. The waterfowl breeding population survey, this is a measure of the pair index of the number of waterfowl species in those areas, and gives us an idea of what the breeding population will be for that year as well. First, I wanted to give you the data from this year's survey. Looking at water conditions overall in the prairie regions, they were down for if you compare that to last year. Overall, water is looking about average in those areas, and so we had about normal breeding conditions for this year. As far as the population status of some of these species, our geese population in Utah was up from last year. Overall, compared to our long-term average, we are down a little bit, but nothing really to be too concerned about. And across the flyway, geese are still doing well, about at the long-term average. Our tundra swan populations, we do two surveys on these. One of them is a midwinter survey that we do in the Pacific flyway. And those numbers were up from last year, as well as up above the long-term average. The other survey data we look at is a survey that's done in Arkansas, and those numbers are up as well. So overall, swan populations are doing well in our flyway. As far as the duck populations are concerned, there are several species that I just wanted to highlight real quick out of all of these. The first one is the mallard population. We use our mallard population to base our overall season recommendation on. And so when mallard populations are up, we get a more liberal season. When they're down, we get a more restrictive season. So compared to last year, mallards are up again, and compared to the long-term average, they are above that. And so mallards are doing really well. And so we use that as an index to the overall waterfowl populations. Our pintail populations, which have been down for the last decade or so, we're down again this year compared to last year and still maintain that level that's below their long-term average. One of the things that could have possibly influenced this year's survey is that when the prairie pottle regions are drier, pintails tend to go farther north. And so that may be an indication that we just missed some of those birds, but overall we go off of what our survey data shows. And so with it being drier, we did see a reduced number of breeding pairs. Canvasbacks were similar to last year. They're a little above their long-term average and looking well. Scop continued to increase. We did see a decline in the 80s and 90s, but they continue to increase and are above their average from last year and are hanging about right around their long-term average now. And redhead populations, which were about the same as last year and are still above their long-term average. So overall, duck populations are looking really well. So going back to the mallard populations, based upon the high status of mallard populations this year, we were able to receive a liberal recommendation from the Fish and Wildlife Service. So that allows us to have a liberal season package, which is a 107-day season with a maximum bag of 7 birds. There are several restrictions, though, on several species in our flyway. For pintails, we'll be able to have a 107-day season, but we'll only have a bag of 2. Canvasback will be a 107-day season with a bag of 1. And scop will be a 107-day season with a bag of 7. And that's an increase from last year, where we had an 86-day season and a reduced bag on scop. So as far as the season frameworks we're recommending, the duck, merganser, and coot season will begin on October 6th and run until January 19th, and that'll be statewide. The bag will be 7 per day or 14 in possession. And that can include no more than 2 hen mallards, 2 pintails, 2 red hens, and 1 canvasback. The coot bag will be 25 per day and 25 in possession. The goose season frameworks, the dark season in the northern zone will be October 6th through January 19th. Outside of that zone, it'll be October 6th through October 18th with a break there and then resume on the 27th of October and run until January 27th. And the bag will be 3 and daily possession of 6. For the light goose season in the northern zone, season will be October 27th through January 19th with a break there and then resume on February 18th and run until March 10th. And outside that northern zone, the season will be October 16th through January 19th. And then resume again on March 1st through the 10th. And the bag for light geese is 10 daily and 20 in possession. The snipe season will be October 6th through 19th, the same as the duck hunt. And the bag will be 8 daily and 16 in possession. For our swan season this year, the dates will be October 6th through December 9th. And that will be just within the Great Salt Lake hunt management area. And we'll recommend 2,000 permits again this year, which is the same as last year. Falconry season will be October 6th through January 19th. The daily bag is 3 and 6 in possession. And this year, our youth day will be 2 weeks before the opener on September 22nd. As far as shooting hours, we do have some restrictions on the opening day shooting hours. For Box Elder, Salt Lake, Davis, Weber, and Cache counties, that'll begin on 7:30. And that's largely just because of the large number of people we have in our marshes. So we like to be a little bit lighter for safety reasons and for duck identification. The rest of the state will begin a half hour before sunrise and opening day. For the rest of the season, the shooting hours will be half hour before sunrise and an official sunset. We do have some closures that may occur in some of our waterfowl management areas. This is to accommodate Phragmites burns. Phragmites is an invasive plant species that we're trying to eradicate along the Great Salt Lake. And so each year, fall, we try to burn off the areas that have previously been sprayed with herbicide just to reduce that growth that's from the previous year, and also to try to get new species to grow up in that. So if Phragmites burns do occur on some of our WMAs, we'll try to post that in appropriate media outlets and try to pass that word along as soon as we know the dates and times for that. There was one specific recommendation that came from the Northern Region RAC last year. It was brought up by the birding community. They had some issues with the Alp Island Causeway. We had some issues with some bird species that were using that causeway, and it was brought to our attention that it may possibly pose some safety hazards with people hunting along that causeway, as well as people who were viewing birds, having those bird species pushed out of the area. And so Randy Berger, a waterfowl biologist from the northern region, addressed this issue, and he brought together a group of people, members from the birding community, members from the sportsman's committees, as well as the folks at Antelope Island State Park. And they discussed this issue at length and all came to the consensus that a 600-foot buffer along both sides of the causeway, beginning at the fee booth and running all the way to the island, would be the best way to address this issue. So that 600-foot buffer would begin at the edge of the pavement and be on the north and the south sides of that causeway. So Randy did an excellent job on this, and it was well received by all the people who were involved in it, and so that would be our recommendation. And that concludes the recommendations. I'll take any questions.
Any question from the board?
Why is the, I know the answer to this, but why is the Swan area to the Great Salt Lake area only? Why isn't it statewide?
Yeah, we work pretty closely with the Fish and Wildlife Service on that issue. They require us to do several different things in order to have our swan season. One is several different surveys we need to conduct every year, and one is to monitor hunter success. And so we feel like, going back to that, in order to monitor success, we have to actually take measurements off of each swan to determine if it's a tundra swan or a trumpeter swan. And so the best way that we can do that is have people come bring those into our regional offices. And so the best way for us to actually monitor that is to do it up in this northern part of the state where people are closer to our regional offices, where we can monitor that easier. And it's also just the highest concentration of swans in the state around the Great Salt Lake area. And so for those two reasons, that's why we have recommended the hunting season just be around the Great Salt Lake marshes.
So with that being the case, and some swans, whatnot, in the Garfield County area and a region office in Cedar City, wouldn't it be allowable or whatever to have some additional permits in other parts of the state?
It could possibly be. A lot of those swans we see showing up after the second Saturday in December, and that's another part of the Fish and Wildlife stipulations, is that season doesn't go beyond the second Saturday or Sunday, I guess, in December. And so there's really little opportunity to harvest swans in the rest of the state during that season framework. And so that's another reason why we've selected just that Great Salt Lake hunting area.
I just wanted to add a comment to Blair's presentation. I'm the Pacific Flyway representative on the North American Wetlands Council, and I had the opportunity a few weeks ago to fly the Prairie Pothole region in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota and see the conditions there. They're actually pretty good. Things are better in the northern plains than they are the southern plains. But long term, there are some real big issues that are going to affect waterfowl populations. A lot of that country is going back into food crop production, and a lot of those potholes are now being farmed through and put back into corn or beans or whatever. And just a comment that the long-term future of waterfowl in North America is really dependent on what happens in that prairie pothole region. And what happens there is going to be very contingent on what's in the new farm bill. So Congress needs to act on that. It's got good conservation measures in it that provide incentives for landowners to leave their land in conservation for waterfowl and other wildlife. And the Senate version of that bill has much better conservation measures in it than the House bill. But that's something to watch over the next few months. The farm bill will be debated in Congress. What happens in that farm bill will have a dramatic effect on what happens with waterfowl in North America.
Let me ask you, Blair, you mentioned the swans being checked, whatever. Are there trumpeters being shot?
There are. Every year we harvest several trumpeter swans. Within the regulations from the Fish and Wildlife Service, they allow us to take up to 10. After that, we would have to close the season. And so we haven't ever actually reached that. I think the highest we've ever had is 7, and so it hasn't ever been an issue in the past. But trumpeter swan population is slowly increasing, and so it could become an issue at some point. But
are the hunters allowed to keep those trumpeters when they shoot them?
They are.
Any other questions from the board? Not, we'll go to the RAC. Robert, this is your area. Start from the Northern Region.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The motion from the Northern Regional Advisory Council is to recommend the Wildlife Board adopt the Waterfowl Guidebook Rule 657-09 as presented, and it passed unanimously.
Lloyd Briggs from the Northeast.
Northeastern RAC passed the division's recommendation unanimously.
Fred Oswald from the Central.
Mr. Chairman, the Central Region passed the division's recommendations unanimously.
Thank you. Bill Bates from the Southeast.
Although we didn't have a quorum, everybody there recommended that we approve this.
Thank you. And Steve Flinders from the Southern.
Mr. Chair, we passed it unanimously as presented at the same time. And part of the motion was to request that the Wildlife Board consider adopting something for your action log relating to looking at additional opportunities for sandhill crane and tundra swan in other parts of the state, specifically the southern region. We had public comment and a fair amount of RAC discussion pursuant to that.
Okay. Thank you. Comments from the audience? Paul Niemeyer.
Well, this seems to be definitely on this side of the table here. Traditionally, we had swan hunting in southern Utah. Then several years ago, they moved it up to this small area up north. And I think sometimes we forget that southern Utah doesn't end at Provo and start again at St. George. There's a lot of these people that would like the opportunity. So we would ask the Sevier River Ducks Unlimited chapter has talked about this quite a bit. We do ask that you would put that on your action log and look at increasing swan hunting opportunity in other parts of the state and especially down south. The other item, and I don't know, they keep telling me these sandhill cranes are upland game, but, you know, they live on the water and go out in the fields and eat like geese, and then they migrate like geese. But so it's maybe not the right proclamation to be talking about sandhill cranes, but we're getting a lot of natural reproduction down there from Wayne County all through Sevier and San Pete. One day I was hunting geese near one of their roost ponds. I counted over 400 sandhill cranes coming, you know, where you could just really count them. Well, but that population is growing. I think that we've got birds that are actually wintering in Paiute County. And we ask you also to put that on your action log and see if there's some opportunity to move some sandhill crane from its down area, because there is opportunity and they are increasing. It's hard sometimes when they're nesting to get a real feel for it, because they nest around the marshes and along the river and whatever, but we're getting so we can see more of them all the time. So, and then when they start to come in, that season would probably be better a little bit later. It'd probably be better in October. But there is a good population of them that's been building down there. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. I have no other comments from the audience. Board discussion and the motion.
I've got two questions for Blair. First one is on sandhill cranes. Do I remember right that that's based upon flyway population as well as local counts?
Yeah, each year the way we monitor them is we do a specified date survey, which begins on about the 10th to the 15th of September. That's done across the flyway just to get an overall population estimate for swans.
And are we counting the birds down in the area that Mr. Niemeyer's talking about in our statewide counts?
We did last year. I think we only had about six that we actually counted, and so it's something that we'll look into in the future. We may just need to expand that survey. I don't think we've done it more than a year or two down there.
Then on the swan hunting, did you say that Fish and Wildlife Service prohibits hunting after that date, or just that there's some extra steps that you have to go through to get?
Yeah, currently within the guidelines that they publish for us, it has to end on that second Saturday in December or Sunday.
You'll have to get data that shows populations before and after that date or something like that.
Yeah, it's something that we could submit a recommendation to the flyway and it, or to the Fish and Wildlife Service, and it may be adopted.
Thank you.
Bill.
Yeah, as I understand it, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is the one that would make a decision on expanding or contracting swan hunting areas and such. Even if we made a recommendation, it's a Fish and Wildlife Service call.
Okay, Jake.
I'd like to make a motion that we put the swans and the sandhill cranes on the action log to be studied to see if there could be additional tags in other parts of the state.
I support that. Let me make a comment. Okay, seconded by... I'm from the Northeast region, and farmers have already contacted me early this spring about the damage those sandhill cranes. I only say that because we have a lot of sandhill cranes out there, a lot of them, and I'm glad to see that Paul's brought up a count from the southern region. I know we're dealing with the federal government. That may be a problem, but we have a lot of cranes, and there's more opportunity than what we're being given. Okay.
Are you having depredation claims from southern Utah on cranes?
We do occasionally have people who complain about them. It becomes a real big issue for people growing corn because they will go through in the spring and just pick out every little seed in through there. And so it is widespread, and we acknowledge that.
What's your usual process working with the Fish and Wildlife Service? Do you have these kind of discussions with them on an annual basis anyway about the potential to increase hunting areas and harvest numbers?
We do. It's a committee that meets for the whole flyway with all the states in the Pacific flyway. We meet several times a year, and we'll discuss various issues in each state, and we can put forth recommendations to them, which can be adopted by the Flyway Council, which then go on to the service and whether it's adopted or not.
Have you had recent conversations specific to the sandhill cranes or the increased swan opportunities?
Not in my recollection, though. Not since I've been in this position, at least.
Is that something that could be approved on a state-by-state basis, or is it something that has to be approved? I guess if it has to be a state-by-state basis, if we're talking about southern Utah.
Yeah, if we were looking at doing a season down there, something we could probably justify. It would have to be within the framework that they allow us to work in. Based upon our population survey, we get an allotment of a number of cranes we can harvest each year. So, for instance, this year it was 126, and so we recommend a certain number of tags, which will closely hit that target range of harvesting 126 cranes. And so if we were to do a season down there in the future, we'd have to adjust permit numbers accordingly and probably remove pit permits from other areas we're hunting now so we didn't go over our allowed harvest.
Some of that current harvest, though, is probably based on depredation concerns. I know there are concerns in northern Utah. I've spoken with some landowners up there that do just exactly what you say, watch the cranes pick out every kernel of corn that they plant. So
yeah, and that's primarily why we have all those hunts now, is to address depredation issues.
But if you reduce tags in the northern region to increase tags in the southern region, then you're kind of working against yourself.
It would, yeah.
Okay. We've got a motion that's been seconded to approve the waterfowl guidebook and rule as presented. Any other comments from the board?
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me. That's right. It's the action log with the cranes and the swans. Take that motion. All in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Unanimous. Okay. How about a second motion regarding the presentation then? Bill?
I would move that we accept the division's recommendations as presented.
Second. Seconded by John. All in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. Thank you, Blair. Next item on our agenda, Pine View Reservoir Hunting Closure Proposal. Becky Wood. Landowner, homeowner up in that area.
Chairman, board members, I'm Lieutenant Scott Davis from the Northern Region. I'm here to represent the division's position on this recommendation. Came into us in June of this year from a landowner, Becky Wood, who resides in Huntsville and lives adjacent to the shoreline at Pine View Reservoir. I'll let her make her recommendations at this time.
Thank you. Mrs. Wood, you'll state your name.
My name is Becky Wood. I'm a full-time resident of Huntsville, Utah, small town that is encompassed by the Pine View Reservoir Recreation Area, which is part of the Cache National Forest. I apologize for my nerves. I attended, first of all, I want to say how grateful I am to be here and to have my niece come with me today, Olivia. She's a Huntsville person too, and we're so proud of Huntsville. And our grandfather, Charles Wood, settled there in 1860, and we've been there ever since. I want to thank all the people who got me here. I had no idea how to go about this or the process or who to talk to. And Stacy Coons was one of the people emailing me, so many people. I can't remember all their names, but I thank them so much because they directed me and guided me through this process and got me to this spot here right now where I can voice my opinion on this proposal. And I thank you all very much for your time. Last week I went to the RAC meeting and I learned a couple, well, quite a few important things from that meeting. I learned that going into a room full of hunters and asking for a ban on hunting is probably not one of the best ideas I've had. and the other thing I learned from that was one of the men who, I mean, it wasn't just no, it was heck no, but one of the men who said no and voted no expressed his reason for doing that. And I thought a lot about his reason. His reason was, if they said yes to me, they're frightened about closing off their hunting areas. They're avid hunters. I can see that. Not a hunter myself, so it's not something I was really thinking about until I went into that meeting. But anyway, he said that would start like a snowball effect, where they said yes to me, the next person coming up saying we want our area closed off too, that they'd have to say yes to them. But I want you to know two things about that argument. I did not come to that meeting last week as part of like a domino effect or a chain reaction. I had no idea what areas in Utah have been closed to hunting or why they've been closed to hunting. I came only to talk about Huntsville and the Pineview Reservoir area. I think it should be considered as a unique area. It is a unique area. I think it should be considered on its own merits, not as a general, well, we're saying no to you because we want to be able to say no to other people in the future. I think you need to say yes to me because it is such a unique area. And I brought some pictures with me this time. This is the Pineview Reservoir area. That all that blue that you see is Pineview. Our little town of Huntsville sits right here. I don't know if you can, how far back you can see this. All the blue is Pineview, and Huntsville is this little spot here. I've highlighted the town square for you. You can see.
Becky, we need to have you address the board.
Oh, sorry. Okay, thank you. Sorry. Okay, I've highlighted the town square. And you can see, you know, we're just this little, it's a very small land area that started out as a farming community, and more and more people are moving there, and the farmlands that surrounded this is a natural basin area that was, it's a beautiful river bottom area that they turned into a reservoir because of its natural ability to hold water. They turned it into a reservoir in the early 60s, late 50s. The land was bought by the federal government, who started filling up these basins with water, and it became this huge reservoir. Now, last week, they asked me which part I would like close to hunting. I made a big mistake by saying the whole area. Maybe that's not reasonable, and maybe that's not probable, but today I just want to propose a small area called the Huntsville River Bottoms. It's over here on this southeast finger, these are kind of like fingers, of Pineview. This is the highway going around Pineview. You used to be able to drive on old roads right through this area into town. Those are blown up now, and one of those roads is a trail through the Huntsville River Bottoms. It's a small area. It's only approximately about 5 blocks square. The Jefferson Hunt campground is right here in that area on the south end of it. Most of the people who use this area are local people. It's only a block and a half away from my home. You can easily walk into it. And once you've walked down this trail, here's the sign at the entry point on the north end. And this is a Forest Service sign. It calls it the Winter Grove Nature Trail. Mr. Winter was one of the old local residents who had ground down in that area, and there are still apple trees in that campground that he planted. But my point in bringing this sign is it specifies it's a nature trail. That's what most people go there to use this area for. Most people don't go there to hunt, even though hunting is allowed there. They go there just to bike, walk, take a walk, ride horses. Some people in Huntsville are horse owners and can just easily ride down there and not have to go far away from their homes to have a horseback ride. The bulletin board right by this sign, one of the signs on here says no fireworks. I kind of put that kind of into the same category as a gun because it makes a loud noise, and this year, I think, has actually started fires. Of course, this is a real wet area. That's not a concern. There's several streams, and two major rivers are in this area. They run out of the mountains and west into Pineview. This is another sign that is kind of funny because hunting is an intrinsically dangerous sport, and it's not the person firing the gun that's going to get hurt typically. It's somebody out there who's going to get hurt, or possibly. This sign says, please no glass on the beach for your safety. But that's almost kind of humorous to me that they would put up a sign saying you can't have glass here, but you can go and shoot a gun in this area. That's a much more dangerous situation. These are a couple more signs. Now, in this area, this also says Nature Trail. These signs are posted all along this trail that goes through this river bottoms. This sign says hikers, horses, and that's a person on a bike. No motorized vehicles. And I think maybe, I don't know if that's for noise reasons or tearing up the vegetation or both. But in this area, there's a little concrete bench here further down the trail that you can't see in the picture where you can just go sit, take a break and sit there. And my friend, who lives in Huntsville, loves to go down there and read. Last year, she's sitting down there and she hears gunshots. And she's more brave than I am. She walks over to the hunters and starts talking to them and says, how long do you think you guys will be down here? And they said, probably most of the day. Well, she has to take her book and go home because their right to hunt and create noise by gunshots then supersedes her right to sit there and quietly read her book. This is a sign also put up by the Forest Service, which says it describes the different types of wildlife you can see in that area, birds and animals. This last paragraph says, remember to walk quietly through here. Don't make any sudden or loud noises so you can get the maximum viewing potential of the wildlife in the area, which is in complete contradiction to hunting there as a sport or way to use that land. This shows you how dense the bushes are and the trees down there, if you can see that. And I brought one from winter because I thought, well, maybe you'll think, well, yeah, but, you know, in the fall, it's not going to look like that. This is what it looks like in the winter. It's very beautiful, but those dense bushes are still just as dense without leaves. Long shot of it. See all the vegetation in the area. It's very hard to see somebody if you're just walking around out here until you're. Here is a view from my backyard. I'm standing on my lawn taking this picture. There, it's just a line. Here's the old fence. With all of its rules of disturbing the peace and laws like that that would affect like a gunshot noise. And over there, that would be Pine View. It's kind of like having a neighbor that is a beautiful neighbor, but sometimes a noisy neighbor but you don't have any jurisdiction over it because you're in the town and that isn't part of the town, even though it's immediately adjacent to the town. So my proposal is to close hunting to the area commonly known as the Huntsville River Bottoms, approximately a 5-block square area. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Becky. Now, Scott.
I'd also like to thank Mrs. Wood. She's been very cooperative throughout this whole process. I'll present our position at this time. DWR position on proposed hunting closure at Pine View Reservoir, the division does not support this proposal for the following reasons. Utah Code 7610.508 defines where a firearm cannot be discharged, and it demonstrates safety has been addressed in state code. And most of you guys are familiar with this, but you cannot shoot from an automobile from or upon across the highway, at any road sign placed on the highway of the state, at any communication equipment, railroad equipment within Utah State Parks, and this is obviously the most important one, within 600 feet of a dwelling, a building, and structure containing livestock without written permission from the landowner. There are areas at Pineview where hunting, specifically waterfowl hunting, can occur legally and safely, in other words, more than 600 feet from a dwelling or a building. The division has not received any prior complaints or any reports of hunting-related incidents. I've been in this position since 1995, and prior to that, I was the sergeant in 1985, and I don't remember of any complaints. Time frame during which most waterfowl hunts occur at Pineview is relatively short, usually late in the season, December, January, after the reservoir and other waters have frozen over, and at the time when other users are at a minimum, other uses are at a minimum. There is no biological reason to close Pineview to hunting. Closing public property to hunting could create a precedent and invite others to make similar requests, as Ms. Wood mentioned earlier. Then all the difficulties and problems associated with a single closure will be compounded manyfold across the state. If the division is to embark on closing hunting in all areas of the state, that are in proximity to human habitation, homes, cabins, buildings, businesses, highways, campgrounds, etc., tens of thousands of acres will be closed that will need to be described in rule or guidebooks to inform the public. The division, however, will commit to help resolve the citizen issue by increased patrol efforts at Pineview during the hunting season and responding as quickly as possible when notified of a violation or of a situation where the safety of the person or property has been compromised.
Thank you, Scott. Any questions from the board?
I still am a little bit confused about the ownership of the property. Is it Forest Service property?
That's correct, Doctor. Forest Service owns.
And so I guess that leads to my next question. What communication has been made with the Forest Service, and what's their feelings on this whole thing? And
We had made arrangements to meet with the Forest Service in July, and they were unable to meet with us, so I can't speak in their behalf. They've had a lot of, according to our RAC member that represents the Forest Service, they wanted to come to the meeting to discuss this issue, but they've had a lot of fires and were unable to attend.
And then one more question. What kind of other public comment has there been? And maybe Mrs. Wood could address that. I don't know if there's been other members of the community that have been concerned about that. She talked about someone reading a book, but I wondered if there had been any kind of public discussions, town meetings, any of those kind of things that would lead us to believe that there's a big outcry against this.
Probably it'd be best for her to answer that question.
Sorry to make you come back up.
You, I have talked to people in town about this, but it is hard to mobilize people. I talked to the mayor about it, who lives on the other side of the little peninsula Huntsville's on, who is disturbed by hunting noises. But when I told him, you know, I'd like to really pursue this, he said, well, I'm out of town a lot and things like that, but and said he couldn't make these meetings. But anyway, I have been thinking about doing a petition, you know, amongst the town members and the people who live in the community, seeing if they would sign with me on this. But it's hard to mobilize people. I heard that during the Revolutionary War, really only 20% of the population on either side actually fought for their side or promoted the war, either the revolutionaries or the loyalists. It's kind of difficult. People like to talk about it and they like to complain about it, but when it actually comes to doing something, they're like, you go ahead, you do it. So I thought I'd just go ahead and do it. I this petition thing might be something I need to do. And
what's been your conversation with the Forest Service? Have you had discussions with them about this and
what's your
concerns?
I've met some of the Forest Service people. Two people came to my home, and now I'm confused if they worked for the – is Paul Cowley Forest Service? Is he a Forest Service person? And then I had two people come to my home, Mitch Lane and Kevin, I can't think of his last name, who came and talked to me. And I think one of them was with the Forest Service, but I'm not positive. But they were both with – Mr. Cowley asked them to come and speak to me about this, which they did.
Go ahead.
Just one more thing, and then I'll be quiet. What was their general feelings about the situation? And did they have any intent to do anything that they could do?
Mitch actually did like a study, which he still concluded that it wasn't necessary. But I just don't agree with that. I really think it is. I really think it's dangerous to shoot guns down there in that place where so many people just like to go for a stroll. And I don't think it's taking a big chunk of ground away from people who do like to hunt. Most people who go down there are just taking a stroll through the trees and the bushes. It's very pretty, and it's very immediate to where we live, and that's what it's mostly used for.
You've alluded several times to hunting noises. Are you talking about gunshots?
I'm talking about gunshots.
And how often? I mean, the hunting season runs for a certain mm-hmm. period. There's different hunting seasons. What time frame, what seasons are we talking about?
Well, it starts in September, and as far as I know, runs when I was home from work this January 16th, Martin Luther King's birthday, there were people hunting.
So we're talking duck hunters, bird hunters.
Yeah. But I have seen deer hunters walking around down there, too. That's even more dangerous, and I didn't think that was legal because they have a higher-powered rifle, but then those guys I talked with said they thought it was, which really scared me, because last time I saw deer hunters down there, I did call the police, but that has been a couple of years ago when that happened. But it's mostly just a little walking trail, and it's by these beautiful rivers, and of course there's lots of ducks there, but it's mainly used just for a little escape to take a stroll on a peaceful evening when you get home from work. It's a wonderful place to go. And you just can't have that same kind of feeling if someone's shooting a gun. It's impossible. It just is. It's disruptive. It's kind of scary. And just not. And you know what? I heard between last week and this week that there are actually places that are closed, reservoirs that are closed to hunting. I don't know what places they are, but places in the state of Utah that don't allow hunting. I felt like I was the first person on earth to request this when I started talking about it, but I don't think that's true now. I think it's not a popular topic among certain people, but I think the lady reading the book has the right to read her book and in a quiet place. And even the signs say that. Be quiet. Be still here. Let's just look at nature and not shoot it.
Ernie, you had a comment?
Yeah, I would like to point out two of the board members and have the Northern Region verify this. There's probably two sources of the problem. One is recreational shooting, and one is hunting. This board has no authority over recreational shooting. So I'm not sure that we could even address the problem squarely to provide relief for the problem. And Scott, could you please discuss other aspects of recreational versus hunting, and also the hunting area, if you could? Would you estimate the distance from the houses?
You bet, Ernie. In response to your first question,
We have had reports, and one report this year where some guys were shooting clay pigeons in this near this campground. This is on the South Fork of the Ogden River. And first thought is among our officers was that it's not unlawful to discharge a firearm in that area, but it is a littering problem when they're shooting clay pigeons. We were never notified of the problem. Weber County Sheriff's Office has jurisdiction over this area. And I called to see if they'd responded, but they were unable to tell me if they had or not. But anyway, what was your other question, Ernie? I got caught up in all this.
Becky sent one of the photographs she sent, I think, was a picture of a broken window with a fairly small hole in it and then a hole over in the wall. That did not appear to be shotgun hunter, if you will.
No, most likely, who can say for sure, it could have been a deer hunter, I guess, in all honesty. Mitch, Sergeant Lane, measured the distance from Miss Wood's house to this area where they traditionally hunt on the South Fork, and it was like 1,600 feet. And, of course, there's the 600-foot. It's against the law regulation. So we can – that obviously isn't a problem. I'm being somewhat redundant here, but most of this the activity related to hunting is in December and January, as I mentioned earlier. As the reservoir freezes, the water stays – the river stays open, and those guys put their decoys out in the river and hunt ducks.
But clearly the agency and manager that has control over activity on the land and on that little nature trail would be – service.
That's correct.
Thank you. No other questions. Robert, you got a smile on your face. Your rack is the only one that heard this.
Mr. Chairman, we did have some discussion. You could see it in the minutes about safety issues. Who controls the land? The land management agency. We're definitely sympathetic to Mrs. Wood's being able to come and make her proposal, but our motion was to recommend the Wildlife Board not adopt the hunting closure proposal, and it carried unanimously.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any? I have no comment card from the audience. So I'm going to, the Northern region is the only region that had this topic come up for them, and they made the presentation, as Robert said, and they voted that there not be a closure. I'm going to turn it over to the board. You've heard the DWR's proposal. You've heard Mrs. Wood's proposal.
Can I ask one more question? What is DWR committed to do as far as helping alleviate some of the concerns that Mrs. Wood would have specifically?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, you know, if we have people that are hunting in violation of the 600-foot rule, you know, we would respond. It could call, for example, the UTIP line. We'll respond. There's two deputies that live in the Upper Valley near Huntsville. A lot of times we'll call them and they'll help as well because they're closer. But as far as the people that are hunting, it's not illegal, but if they get too close to the residences, then we'd respond to a complaint. Or if we have a litter problem, we respond to that as well.
Jake, you're next.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to make a recommendation to the division that they work with the landowners around this area to increase visitation or have some of their officers there maybe a little bit more often, and to work with the Forest Service to see if they can fix some of these problems that this young lady's talked about. But also I'm going to make a motion that we deny the closure of the hunting on the Pine View Reservoir.
Any further discussion? Second, yes.
I'll second that motion. And but along with that second, I just, you know, tell Ms. Wood we appreciate her coming. I know it can be intimidating to come to a room usually full of hunters and make a presentation. I thought you did well, but I would have to agree with the motion that Jake made. You know, there's a rule around shooting around residences and across roads, and I think this is an area where those rules would be the ones that would apply, and that that law enforcement would look to enforce and to help regulate this area. I don't think closing hunting is the thing to do. So,
you know, quite a question or a comment. You know, even if we did vote to close the hunting, that doesn't preclude somebody from target shooting in that area. You know, all we can do is close the hunting, but we cannot limit someone from hunting. That would have to be a Forest Service, where the Forest Service has jurisdiction there. They would have to go through the process to close any firearm discharge. So even if we did close hunting, someone could still be target shooting for whatever reason in that area.
Okay. Had a motion by Jake, seconded by John, that we deny the closure of hunting. Call for vote. All in favor? Unanimous. Thank you, Mrs. Wood. The vote has been that we deny the closure of hunting. There will be hunting there, but we do appreciate our officers, the DWR, particularly Justin and Scott, who's worked with you, and thank you for coming. Appreciate you. And the DWR, I'm sure, is going to try to do their very best to help you and keep that as clean as they can possible. Thank you. I think now would be a good time to take a break. I want to make this a short one because we're moving, so we'll take a 10-minute break and be right back and get started. If you could take your seats, we want to get started here. Next item on our agenda is the conservation permit allocation for 2013 through 2016. Kevin Bunnell, want to give us that presentation, if you will, Kevin?
I'd be glad to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. You remember in June, we brought out the rule and amended the rule, and now we're making the allocation in accordance to the new rule. Just wanted to point that out. This is all following the rule that was approved in June. Just to point out briefly, in the beginning, the accomplishments are in the last three-year cycle. We kind of do conservation permits in a three-year cycle, the majority of them. During the last 3 years, we've raised over $8 million through conservation permits. That's contributed to the improvement of over 225,000 acres of habitat. Now, that didn't completely pay for that. Obviously, there's other partners that come in. It's also contributing funding to important research projects such as the Monroe Fawn Study, limiting factors to moose, highway mortality, and several others. So we're trying to make as best use of these funds as we possibly can for the benefit of wildlife. I'll go through species by species and kind of give you a comparison of what was issued in 2012 versus what we're recommending. Just by way of kind of some coding, anything that's in blue in the right-hand side is an increase over what we had in 2012. Anything in kind of that orange color is a decrease. So on deer, we have, one thing I'll point out on deer, we've taken out the Fillmore Oak Creek unit out of the conservation permit program because of the fires that were down there. We did add one permit to the Book Cliffs. But in total, we're down two fewer permits for deer for the next three-year cycle than we had
in the previous 3 years. So we went from 40 down to 38. Elk, these are a little small, but you can see there's a lot of, some units went up, some units went down. The total is a difference of eight permits. We're eight permits fewer on elk than we were in 2012, going from 118 to 110. And again, this is all just according to the formula or the table that's in the rule. Pronghorn, similar. We went a total of 40 down to 35. A few increases, a few decreases, but the sum of that is a five permit decrease. Moose is probably the most drastic change. We've been reducing moose permits. We're down to now, according to the table, there's only one unit that qualifies for moose permits, and that's the Wasatch Mountains. And so we've gone from eight moose permits down to three. So two on the Wasatch Mountains, and then the statewide permit is all that will be remaining in the program for moose for the next 3 years. Mountain goats, a little bit different story. Our populations are increasing, and we've increased tags, which translates into a slight increase in the number of permits, going from seven up to 10. Bison, status quo, no changes in the number of bison permits. And we've had four, and we're recommending that we continue to have four. Rocky Mountain sheep, an increase of one, and that's because the 9 Mile Range Creek qualifies for two permits by itself now. And so we're recommending an increase from four up to five on Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep. Desert bighorn sheep, and on this one we're changing the way that we've combined units. The rule states that for sheep you can combine units so you can qualify for a conservation permit. We've shuffled the units around a little bit from what they have been, but the end result is the same. We've had six permits, and we'll continue to have six permits for desert bighorn sheep. And moving forward, the other thing that we're going to do to make sure that there's any confusion is non-resident permits for sheep will match the conservation permits because they're also combined for the purposes of non-residents. So those will be will mirror each other. Turkeys, pretty standard with turkeys. It's actually an increase of two, but with now the statewide over-the-counter turkey hunting, and we'll have eight regional permits for the limited entry portion of the turkey permit for each region. Cougar, a slight increase from 17 up to 21. That's a result of the fact that we've taken several units that were just straight harvest objective units. They're now split units, which means that there's a limited entry portion of those. Which then goes into the calculation for conservation permits because we base those on the number of limited entry permits or the number of draw permits. With bear, it's also an increase from 19 up to 24. That's a result of we have been increasing bear permits over the last several years, and that's now reflected in an increase in the number of bear permits that we're offering. I will point out that although there were a number of permits authorized for a spot and stock bear hunt beginning actually last spring, we haven't included any of those in the conservation permit program because that's a brand new hunt. We want to see how that we're gonna have to work out some kinks on that before we kind of indoctrinate it into this type of a program. So we didn't use any of the spot and stock bear hunts in calculating conservation permits for bear. So just in summary, you can see the total is a difference of 45 permits, fewer than we had in 2012. 40 of those come in the form of we're not recommending any antlerless elk, which there was 20 of those, or any general season deer, which had been part of the rule in the past. Those have been removed from the rule, so they're not even an option anymore now that we've gone to unit by unit deer hunting. So a total of we had 342 approved for 2012. We're recommending a total of 297 for the next 3 year cycle. So again, these recommendations follow the new rule, and then the number of permits recommended for the next three allocation. It's actually a reduction of 56 big game permits. Again, 40 of those are in the form of antlerless elk and general season deer, but still 16 of the bucks and bulls and once in a lifetime permits. And then an overall reduction of 45 permits. With that, I thank you for your attention and be glad to answer any questions.
Director Karpowicz.
Just one question, Kevin. At the last board meeting, there was a lot of discussion about the rule change resulting in a big increase in the number of conservation permits. It looks to me like from your presentation, there's fewer big game permits available for the next three-year cycle. Is that right?
There are, and we followed the table with the exception of pulling out Oak Creek deer tags and elk tags. We followed the rule exactly to come up with this recommendation. So.
Okay, and was it, did the rule result in making that easier for you to?
Well, now that the table's, the table's just part of the rule, yes, it's a lot more straightforward.
All right, thanks.
And let me just try to chew on this. 56 permits, but 40 of them were antlers, elk, and general season deer.
Yes.
So there's 16 big game permits that you lost, which is
16 bucks, bulls, once in a lifetime.
Yeah, that's big dollar items. So we could anticipate that the dollar value is going to be lower just because of those permits.
I'm not going to bring that. There's so many other factors that go into that, Dale. Sometimes fewer means more because, you know, it's a supply and demand.
Thing.
So, and the economy and how much money people have in their pocketbooks makes a big difference as well. So,
yeah.
We'll see how it goes.
Okay. Yeah, maybe the auctioneer has the input. Give it to the uncle or give it to me. Okay. Any questions from the board? Questions from the RAC? No questions from the RAC? Any questions from the audience regarding the presentation? No questions?
We ask if questions or comments.
Questions right now. Yeah. So let me go to the RAC chairs, then we'll come to comments from the audience. So, Steve, can we start with you again?
Dale, the RACs did not hear this.
The RACs didn't hear this. Okay. Then we'll go to the comments. First, Eric Tyson, is it? Tyson. The Mule Deer Foundation. You catch that, Stacy?
I'm with you. I'm Eric Tyson, Chief Operating Officer for the Mule Deer Foundation. I'd like to just address the board and state that we are 100% in support of the Conservation Permit Program. And mostly in support of the recommendations for the conservation permit allocation, with one exception. We would like to petition the board to ask the division to put the antlerless elk permits back into the program. And I understand that one of the issues that the division has is that there's confusion over the regional antlerless elk permits. And I believe that they can include the antlerless elk permits, but include them unit by unit as a unit antlerless elk instead of a regional. If they do this, we enjoy taking those antlerless elk permits to our fundraisers throughout the state of Utah. And what it does is it provides an opportunity for us to give a youth or to provide a youth with one of those hunts. And it also provides an opportunity for the average individual to be able to purchase a conservation permit and go out and hunt antlerless elk. Any questions for me?
Questions? Thank you, Eric. Next, Bill Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Christensen. I'm the Regional Director for the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And I just want to thank the Division of Wildlife and the Wildlife Board for one of the most successful conservation programs I've seen in my 30-year career in wildlife issues in Utah. I was involved with the genesis, starting with governor's permits and moving on to conservation permits and in the evolution of this program. And I compliment this board, your predecessors, Jim and the division and all those that have gone before. This is one of the greatest programs in all the West. And as Jim has said many times, other states look at this program and like it and care about it. With 90% of the funds going back on the ground to benefit wildlife conservation in the state, no other program has done more. Maybe with the addition, of course, the Watershed Initiative as part of that. than any other program I've been involved with, and I want to compliment the division and the board for this, and I'm wholeheartedly, as are our members, staff, and volunteers, in favor of this issue. I'd also like to speak to what Eric spoke to, the antlerless elk permits, especially at a time where we're going to be taking more antlerless elk later in the year because of the drought. This is a permit that goes to our fundraisers that guys like me that aren't rich and average Joe guys can bid on and have a fun hunt and help conserve and manage elk. I would like to see the antlerless elk tags also put back in the program just because it's an affordable way for the average guy to have fun at an auction. Unless John's the auctioneer, then they might go a bit higher. But we very much appreciate this program, and I speak from experience when I say that this has been a wonderful program. And I appreciate the chance to speak and would answer any questions you may have.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Byron Bateman.
Byron Bateman, I'm the president of Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, and I just want to echo what Eric and Bill said, that there's no question this is one of the greatest programs that's ever been put together here in Utah, especially in a year like this that Jim mentioned earlier with the drought and the fires that we've had. We raised over $8 million in the last 3 years. It's great to know that we have the resources available and money available to mitigate any future fires and stuff like that that might, you know, happen in the state of Utah. This program really helps that. It's sad that we lost some of the big game tax because more does mean more in the long run. But I just want to go along and accept what Kevin's presented here as the numbers and the recommendation the next 3 year period. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Last comment card I have is Jerry Hill. Do we have Jerry here? And I'll just read what he's written here, his comments. Permits given out of a public resource should benefit the public and the wildlife resources. Funds raised from these public tags should go back to the DWR to benefit said wildlife. Accountability of these funds raised should be shown to the public and also show that they are returned to benefit wildlife, not just a select few. Please have them show accountability. The comment to that is the three primary conservation groups, MDF, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and SFW, and I'll throw in the Safari Club. They haven't been here today, but annually they are audited by the DWR, and we see those figures annually when those audits are made and given. And this has already been made, comment from Director Karpowitz, as well as our three groups. Utah is light years ahead of the rest of the state because of this program. So I appreciate personally what these groups have done for us. And the accountability, as I see it, is there. Thank you. That's the last of our comment cards. Board summarizes. Let's see. Do we have any comments or questions from the board? Ernie first, then Jake.
Kevin, could you stand back up again, please, and talk through the antlerless elk permit topics, the reason that they were removed, and so forth and so on?
Well, they were they were something that was, and Alan may have to correct me on the history here if I get it wrong, but I don't think they were part of the program to begin with. They were requests from the groups that, that came, and the board approved them. It put them into the program. We've kind of gone back to our original proposal that it's you know, we don't have any big objections to antlerless elk. being part of the program. But I would echo what Eric said, or follow up on what Eric said. If the board chooses to put antlerless elk back in, I would like the ability to change how that they're not a regional permit anymore. That's been very confusing, both for the conservation organizations as they're being auctioned, for the people that receive those permits, and it's pretty complicated for our licensing folks to issue those. There's a way we can do those on a unit basis, still gives opportunity and gives the permit some value, but will reduce a lot of the complexity that's currently a part of that. And that complexity is part of the reason we aren't recommending them in this round.
So let me just clarify myself. That's a possibility, but the request is that it be on a unit basis rather than a regional basis.
Yeah, if the board chooses to add those back in, I just ask for the flexibility to do it in a way that's less complicated, less complex than it has been.
Okay. Other comments, Jake? You had one?
Answered.
Answered.
I got a
John?
Comment. I just kind of going along with what Kevin said. When you're selling a permit, I don't think I've ever been asked as many questions about any permit as I have when we're selling a antlerless elk tag, because people are used to units, and then when you tell them it's a region tag, it is confusing. And I think if there's a way to simplify that, I think it would be better to do it by unit, because people are familiar with the units and they know what they're, you know, without question, what they're buying. They're buying a Buckcliff's antlerless tag or a Manti or a Wasatch antlerless tag. I think that would be good. I also, just kind of speaking to the existence of the tags, it's kind of fun to see a little kid sitting next to mom and dad bidding on a tag, and he buys a cow tag for whatever it is, you know, between $100 and $500, whatever, and be all excited because he's going on his first elk hunt, and he feels like he's something big because he got a bid on the tag and whatnot. And I think there's a little value there to those things. So, you know, but I do think that if they're going to exist, they need to be on a unit, not a region.
And following up on that, I mean, some of that complexity on a region, you know, our units don't follow our regional boundaries. So you take the Manti, for instance. Half of it's in the central region, half of it's in the southeastern region. Those are the kind of things that have added to the confusion on this. Because a guy gets a southeastern tag, and, well, can I hunt the Manti or not? Is it included in the southeastern region or included in the central region? And it's become an issue. It's also been an issue on cougar tags in the past. If you notice, the recommendation is to now put those based on our cougar management areas, not on our administrative boundaries, which will also mean all the units are combined. And a guy can then go to the proclamation and know where he can hunt. And so that's another change that will make things simpler.
I don't know if these two issues are related or not, but a little later on today we're going to talk about a bunch of additional antlerless elk tags available for this year anyway. You throw 1,400 antlerless tags out there, possibly what kind of impact would that have on the ability to sell these tags at an auction?
I think they're pretty separate issues, Mike. They're not a tag that's part of the program to try to raise a bunch of money. There's a different, you know, it's more of a philosophical question on whether antlerless tags are be part of this program or not. The argument for it is, you know, kids and maybe it allows some tags to be part of the program that and fight against the perception that it's only for the guys that have a lot of money. It allows people that aren't in that situation to participate in the conservation permit program. But in terms of impacts, 20 antlerless elk tags spread across the state are going to have zero impact on the resource.
I just wondered if you'd be able to sell them.
They've always sold in the past. I think they'll continue to, and the value may come down as a result. And it'll wax and wane over the 3-year period as our antlerless elk tags increase or decrease based on a whole separate process for managing to our objectives. So,
Kevin? Okay.
Is that 20 a set number?
That's what we've had in the past. I would be pretty nervous if we went much above that. That's kind of the standard that's been set. But 20 is what's been in the program for the last 3 years.
Ernie?
Kevin, I assume that if the board did authorize some tags, your unit selection process would be good public access, large units that have large numbers of permits on them already, and distributed around the state so that banquets in St. George would have a few and banquets in the Cache Valley would have a few.
Exactly. Those are exactly the criteria that we would use, Ernie. Units that are over objective now, so we would assure that there's, you know, we're going to be working and issuing analysts elk permits so that they qualify for the program that way and don't violate the rule in terms of having limited entry tags available. And we would put them on units that would have, we would be assured would continue to have some antlerless elk hunts through this 3-year period. So.
Let me just make a personal statement, you know, and these sportsmen's organizations, they've said it, and I'm just going to reiterate what they've said, what John has said, you know. It is fun to see mom and dad or grandma and grandpa bid for these kids and give them youth a chance to go on an elk hunt. And, Mike, I don't think that the numbers are going to hurt because that's not what's creating the bid. It's the parents or the grandparents giving these youth a chance. And we talk about youth recruitment. That is one of the real good ways to do it that I've seen so many times. Those kids are just beside themselves as their granddad raises their hand. So I'm all in favor of it.
Yeah. And 20 a year is pretty low recruitment value, but
yeah,
it's 20 a year.
So. But, you know, the kid's going to buy more than one permit.
Yes, but we need to get a lot more than 20 youth a year into hunting is what my comment was towards.
They're probably already into it, to be honest with you. But
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd make a motion that we approve the conservation permit allocations for 2013 through 2015 with the addition of the 20 cow elk tags to be at the discretion of the Division of Wildlife Resources, how they want to do that.
Just a point of clarification, using the criteria that Ernie mentioned earlier?
Correct.
Okay.
Distribution.
Yeah, so we've got those on the record, so I can go back to them.
Do you need to say antlerless instead of cow?
Antlerless cow elk.
I'm familiar.
Still a cow. Still a cow.
I'll second that motion.
Okay. The motion has been made and seconded that we support the DWR proposal for the conservation permit in addition to 20 antlerless cow elk permits, which would be distributed based on the DWR's prior experience and the guidance that Ernie gave them.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think it would be appropriate. I do contract work with all these organizations as the auctioneer. I've sold all these tags, and I think it would be appropriate to keep things squeaky clean if I recuse myself from a vote on the conservation permit, so I won't be voting. But I, you know, would like to say that I think it's a great program in light of the disastrous fire year and drought we're having. I think it's, you know, we're lucky to have a program like this, and it's good to see the groups here and cooperating and agreeing on what's going on. So
thank you, John. I hate to lose your vote. Okay, we've got a vote, a motion, a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. Thank you. Moving on. Next, we got 40 minutes for lunch. Convention permit allocation. Alan Clark.
Actually, we're going to tag team this, Alan and I, and we're doing the audit, right? The one above.
Excuse me, that's right. The one above it.
Right, and I'll start with just a brief introduction, and then Alan will take over. Yes, Greg is still in Africa. He should be doing this today, and he's not here. For all we know, he got ate by a lion.
That wouldn't serves, be much
serves him right.
Dangerous than the other one.
Just to introduce this topic, I'd like to take a few minutes and go back and review the history of the convention permit program. I think this information will be important as we go through the next three agenda items. One thing that became clear to me as I've done a lot of research on this topic is that there's a great deal of confusion among the public, the board, the division, the difference between conservation permits and convention permits. And I think every one of us has used the wrong term at different times. And so it's not unreasonable that the public's confused on this. I think there's also a lot of misinformation out there that's led to a lot of misunderstanding about both of these programs. So I'd like to just mention a couple of things as a preface to this. First of all, I want to talk about the meeting March 31st, 2005. This is where the convention permit program was approved by the Wildlife Board. This was just before I became director and before any of the current board members were on the board. So I've had to go back and kind of reconstruct what happened. I can tell you I've looked at the minutes of all of the RAC and board meetings pertaining to convention permits over the past 8 years, and I've listened to the recordings of many of those meetings, and I've talked to several people who were at this meeting on March 31st, 2005. Out of that meeting came three main issues that were discussed by the public on the board and concerns from the public and the board. One was how the drawing would be conducted, then how the convention would raise funds for wildlife, and whether there should be an audit. And there were two motions that came out of that meeting that were approved by the board. The first motion was to accept the rule as presented. And then right at the end, there was an additional motion made that said, we asked the division in their contract negotiations with the representing organizations that the annual audits be accomplished in a similar way that is done for conservation tags. And I'd like to talk for a minute about this last motion. Without going into a lot of detail, I can tell you it's not easy to understand exactly what was meant by this last motion, because the rules for the two programs are so very different, and it did not make much sense that the audit should be done exactly like it was being done for conservation permits. It added to the confusion when the division asked the maker of the motion earlier in the meeting to clarify what he thought should be in the audit. And he stated that he did not think the $5 application fee was the issue at all. So after researching this meeting and what went on there and talking to a lot of people that were there, I've concluded that at least the division people who were at that meeting left that meeting unclear on what exactly the intent of the board was beyond the requirements that were in the rule that they had just approved. However, I think nearly everyone at that meeting understood that the $5 application fee would be used to cover both the costs associated with the drawing and to fund wildlife conservation activities. It's also reasonable to assume that the board knew that most of the $5 fee, application fee, would be used to pay for costs associated with the drawing, since the division application fee was $5 at the time. And I'd just like to point out that it currently costs the division more than $5 to administer the regular drawing. And I think it should be remembered that this is an application fee. It's not a license fee or a permit fee, and it's not state funds as such. The groups are not allowed to keep any of the associated license and permit fees, which are state funds, nor are they allowed to auction the permits like they do conservation permits. So, moving on, in January 2006, the first convention contract was signed with the organizations. There was a provision in that contract for annual audits. In January of 2007, the first convention was held in Salt Lake City in and then from 2007 to 2009, the first three conventions, the division conducted informal audits of the convention. We were especially focused on what happened with the drawing. So we carefully monitored the application and drawing procedures to make sure that the drawing occurred fairly and accurately. We also tracked the funds raised by the application fee. We knew how much funds the convention was making, and we were working with the convention groups to identify wildlife and habitat projects for funding with convention dollars. If you look at the list that the groups have supplied in the past and the ones that they're going to give to the board today, many of those projects were identified and proposed by the division, and we were grateful to have those convention groups fund those projects. It should also be pointed out that there was a board meeting each of these years to discuss the convention permit program and to approve the annual allocation of permits. The board had ample opportunity to make a course correction and provide the division with additional direction concerning the convention permit program if they felt like we were not following their intent. So we believed at that time that we were following the intent of the board. In May of 2010, the division decided we should be providing the board with a written audit of the convention program and that we should clarify and rule what exactly the audit should encompass in the future. So in May and June of 2010, we took the audit and the rule amendment out for to the public for review. There were questions and concerns expressed by some RAC members at three of the RAC meetings. However, all five RACs voted to approve the rule amendment as presented, and the board also approved the rule amendment. So in September of 2010, a new contract was approved with the convention, MDF being the lead on that contract for the years 2012 to 2016. And at that meeting, the groups passed out a list of project expenditures for 2007 to 2010. It was presented to the board and available to the public at that meeting. And then again, in August of 2011, a written audit of the convention program was presented to the board. And then I just want to make this one final point. It's important to note that no one from the public voiced any concern at any of these public meetings with either the audits or the rule amendment, and thus they were passed by both the RACs and the board. So on to the current situation. In the past several months, some members of the public have expressed concern over the convention permit program and the need for more oversight of the $5 application fee. The division recently met with the convention groups, and they have volunteered to provide a more detailed report for 2011 and 2012 that includes three things: the total amount of funds raised by the application fee, the costs of administering the drawing, and expenditures on wildlife conservation activities. And I understand they are prepared to submit that report to the board today. I've seen that report, and I've gone and back and added up all of the project expenditures that will now have been reported to the board from 2007 to present, and it adds up to $1.62 million. So, you know, I'm pleased to see that the groups are voluntarily providing this information, but I also believe it's appropriate for the board to make this report a requirement in the convention contract. And I believe the contract allows for the board to make a stipulation to make this a requirement. So the division is recommending to the board today, as part of your approval of the 2012 audit, that you add a stipulation to the convention contract making this annual report a requirement beginning in 2013. The board can then review that annual audit and judge whether the groups are using these funds appropriately. Ultimately, it will be the Wildlife Board who will determine whether there will continue to be a drawing at the convention. So that's what we're recommending to the board in regards to this audit. Also, I think it's worth discussing just for a minute whether the convention has achieved its purposes stated in rule. The rule states that the convention was authorized for two purposes. One is to generate rule for what generate revenue to fund wildlife conservation activities and to attract a regional or national convention to Utah. And now just a few comments about the convention. I want to take the second part of that first. It has certainly attracted a very large convention to Utah that has great value to the state of Utah. It's attended by 20 to 30,000 visitors each year, and it's safe to say that convention permits have provided an incentive to attract visitors to this convention, and they've been a big part of helping make the convention successful. Just a comment about the economic value of this convention. A 2009 report by the Beaver Institute at the University of Utah showed that there was $8.5 million spent by visitors at this convention, over 19,000 hotel nights, which generated $774,000 tax dollars and provided 155 jobs for Salt Lake County. And then an important note that the convention has grown by 40 to 50% since 2009, and I think it's fair to increase all those numbers by 40 to 50%. So the convention has been, the convention permit program has helped attract a big convention to Utah, and that convention has in turn generated a lot of revenue for the state. The convention also showcases Utah's wildlife management programs and our outstanding big game opportunities in Utah, and has generated a lot of interest in what's going on in Utah. I also think it's fair to say that the convention is a public-private partnership that's working towards a common objective of enhancing wildlife populations and habitat in Utah. Now, as to the first objective of the conservation permit program, does it generate revenue for wildlife conservation? Well, the part that's most discussed of late is the revenue from the $5 application fee. And I can tell you that many good projects have been funded by the conservation groups that were good for wildlife and sportsmen. And after you see the list today, that adds up to $1.62 million. There's also increased revenue from hunting licenses that were purchased in order to be able to put in for permits in the convention. That's only existed since 2008. But everybody that puts in for a convention permit has to buy a base $26 hunting license in Utah or a $30 combination. And non-residents have to pay the non-resident fees, which are much higher. There's also increased revenue. I believe there's increased revenue from conservation permits that are auctioned at the convention. The convention generates so much interest and excitement that we've seen permits sell at that convention at high prices, and as we just discussed previously, 90% of that money comes back to wildlife projects. So the other thing we've seen is I believe there's been increased participation in Utah's regular big game drawing because of the convention. It's interesting that applications in Utah's drawing have increased by 49% since the first convention, while other states have declined. And our interest has grown steadily over the years in our big game drawing. So just in summary, and then I'll shut up, I believe the convention has been good for the state of Utah, and I believe it's been good for wildlife in Utah. The division has made sure the convention groups have followed the convention permit rule over the years, and we've made an annual report to the board every year since 2007. And the division is now proposing that we add a mandatory reporting requirement to the contract. With that, I'd like to have Alan now move on to the 2012 audit, and then Alan and I can answer any questions the board or the public may have.
Stacy's going to magically make my presentation appear. I'm Alan Clark, the assistant director with the division. I've thought back after having done wildlife stuff for about 40 years about the worst mistake I ever made in my life. And I think the worst mistake I ever made in my life was naming this the convention permits when we already had conservation permits. And actually, it was interesting with all the discussion, and I went back through all my notes, and the first draft of the rule, we called this the wildlife festival permits, and that got immediately X'd out on the first review. So we almost had festival permits, which probably would have been even more controversial now as we went through. So let me do this. As Jim mentioned, Greg Sheehan actually performed the audit. I'm not an auditor. And so, but I'll report, I worked with Greg on reviewing all of this before he left, and can cover that and answer some of the questions. You do have a written copy of this, so I'm just going to cover the high points, so it won't be the details. And we'll go through that.
There are also written copies available to the public on the table.
That's right. So a little of this will overlap real quickly, and I'll skim through it with what Jim did, but the requirements that when it was adopted in 2005, and the rule's been amended a few times over the course of the years it's been there, but it's to provide up to 200 limited entry permits for a variety of species for issuance at a wildlife convention to be held in the state of Utah with an anticipated attendance of at least 10,000 people. So that's what's in the rule as far as those initial requirements. The initial rule established these permits for a five-year period. And so when the rule was passed by the Wildlife Board, it said there will be conventions from 2007 to 2011, convention permit series. And the board only ruled and only it dealt with the permits because that was what was under their purview, is issuing the permits. If the rule had never been amended, we wouldn't have a wildlife convention right now. It would have ended in 2011, would have been the last year. So the board actually built a sunset into the rule that they passed. The permits were available as a group to a conservation organization, and we say as a group, or we called it a permit series. So in other words, we wouldn't have multiple groups getting pieces of it. It went to one group because we wanted one group accountable for the situation. And so they were there, and the group had to demonstrate a record of enhancing protected wildlife species in Utah. The permits were to be issued through a random drawing process with an application fee of $5. So that's all was in that initial rule. Applicants could apply for all hunts, but they could not accept more than one permit for any one species. So that's covered by state code. So one deer. If they drew two deer, they don't get to keep two deer. You go to the first alternate to give the next one out. The Wildlife Board must approve the permits in the convention permit series each year. So every year since that first year, since the year after that rule was passed, every year the Wildlife Board has approved those permits. Those permits, again, are subtracted from those that are approved by the board for the normal permit drawing. They're not add-ons, they're not anything else, they're just subtracted. All permits are available to both residents and non-residents except... And now we're moving into the more recent changes. One of the changes is there are five permits that are reserved for non-residents that's used as a tool. They come out of the non-resident quota on our drawing that's conducted by our contractor in Nevada. And so they don't penalize residents. They come out of that quota. But so those five that are only available to non-residents come out of the non-resident quota on the regular drawing. And waiting period restrictions do not apply for those applying for the permits at the convention. And the only person who incurs a waiting period as far as it goes to the normal drawing is someone who draws a once-a-lifetime species. Anybody who gets a once-a-lifetime species anyway, buying it from a CWMU, whatever way they get it, buying a conservation permit of that, that incurs their once-a-lifetime for applying in the regular drawing. So, and we kept that consistent. That was the same as we were doing already. The current status after completion of the original five-year contract, the rule was revised to allow for a second five-year convention permit series. went out through the racks through that whole process because the rule itself was amended to build that in. After being open for competitive bid, the contract was awarded to the Mule Deer Foundation in 2010 for the contract years of 2012 through 16. MDF has a partner organization, Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, that works cooperatively on the convention, but our contract is with Mule Deer Foundation. That's who the contract that the state has is with. Although the rule defined this contract and permit series as convention permits, you'll hear people refer to them as the Hunt Expo because the permits, Hunt Expo permits, because that's the name of the convention being administered by those two groups. So you'll see that, but it means the same thing. The Hunt Expo permits or convention permits are those. So the division has conducted an audit of the 2012 convention. As I mentioned, Greg had assistance from his staff, but he was the one who oversaw that. The scope of the audit included ensuring that, and these are right out of the rule. So what we did is we went to the rule and said, what does the rule say we need to do? And so we went into the rule. It says sensitive and confidential data is properly handled. And I said, it should say the rule or the contract is handled and secured. The drawing processes for the convention were conducted using the methodology as agreed to with the division. So make sure the drawing's conducted fairly and unbiased. The computer programming for the applications and drawing of the permits was designed to run properly and selected permits randomly. And we have our IT people check through all of that and run tests with the person who conducts that to make sure it is working that way. That selected applicants were verified for eligibility for the possession of the permits before being issued a permit. So anybody who's on suspension, who can't have a permit, we make sure that they, even if they might have applied, they're not allowed to have a permit. So we check that against our database. That applicants had a hunting or combination license to apply. That, as Jim mentioned, that was a requirement that went in place in 2008, I believe, right, Jim, 2008? And that applicants were not required to enter the paid area of the convention to apply. That was one of the things that was an important issue to the board the first year, is that people shouldn't have to pay an entrance fee in order to apply in this drawing. Those of you that have gone to the convention, they do all of that operation outside in the lobby. You don't have to pay or buy a ticket of admission or anything to be able to do that. A review of the number of applications, success rate of residents versus non-residents was also included. So you'll see a little bit of that's in the audit and detail tables, but I'll cover a little bit of that. So a little bit about the drawing information, and we're comparing 2012 to 2007 through 11. Applicants in 2012 were up over the average. Total applications were up. And therefore, the gross revenue at $5 per application is up for 2012. So those are the actual numbers. The average applications per applicant were actually down. In this case, it's not an analysis we do in our normal drawing because you can only apply for one limited entry or one once in a lifetime. But in the convention, one of the things that makes it unique, the convention permit drawing, is you can apply for more than one. So you see that it went down. So number of participants is up. Number of individual permits they apply for is down on average. A little bit of the comparison. One of the things that was an important issue, and it was reflected in the rule, and I'll talk about that when we actually get to what permits we're recommending that you authorize for the 2013 convention. It was important that non-residents not take resident permits. The perception at the time the convention was there is that most of the permits would go to non-residents. I think, Ernie, you were around at that time, and that was a big concern. And I know, Bill, you had some concerns at that time as well as a RAC member, is that it was done fairly. So one of the things we do every year is we analyze that to see what percent of the applications versus what percent of the permits. And if you compare those two percentages, you actually find out that residents do slightly better than non-residents on some of that situation as far as is their success rate in getting permits and where they go. I think the reason for that, Greg and I didn't analyze it, we discussed it, but there wasn't time to look into it, but I think residents apply for more of the lower value permits, whereas non-residents apply almost exclusively for once in a lifetime. So not many non-residents, I suspect, apply for turkey permits in Utah because most of them come from states that have as good or better turkey hunting, whereas so that's something that a lot of residents apply for in the package that they do. So other information, the convention had over 26,000 attendees. Remember, we have to compare that to 10,000. That's in the rule. At the point in time it falls below 10,000, the group is out of compliance. In 2012, with more than 13,000 formally registered, and that's the people applying in the drawing. So there were 925 hunting licenses that were sold actually at the Hunt Expo. In order for people to be able to apply for those permits, they have to have a license. This year, we set the Hunt Expo up as a license agent, so all $37,023 comes back to the division, just the same thing it does as Walmart or any other license agent in the state. So we accounted for all of that money. Others were sold in advance of the expos. People pre-registered. There's a pre-registering option that's available, and all of these funds were returned to the division. So, and then Greg went through and reviewed those other things about the records, and his conclusion, these are his conclusions that are in writing, all sensitivity and confidentiality measures were complied with as identified by the audit review, and he had no other findings or recommendations that were made. So there wasn't anything changes that came through the audit that said this has to change in the process. And so that is the conclusion of the audit part, and as Jim mentioned, he or I can answer questions about any of this.
Any questions from the board?
And again, this is not an item since there's no rule amendment, this isn't an item that went to the RACs, Dell. This is just something that's done to the board or with the board.
No questions from the board? Ernie?
Just at some point, I'd like to get the permit holder, MDF's response to the division's recommendation, if that's going to occur during.
Yeah, they're on the comment card from them.
Okay.
Questions from the public?
Yeah. Do we have any questions from the public? Questions. Good job.
Yes, Tony Abbott, just representing myself. The question is, Jim, is there an audit or an accounting for each individual year since its inception, or just the last year or two that you guys gave us?
We have. In 2010, the convention groups provided us a list of expenditures for 2007 to 2010. And I understand today the groups are going to provide 2011 and 2012.
Perfect. Thank you.
And also to clarify, Greg went back and did this similar audit for those years as well. So it's not just the project stuff that Jim talked about, but also the audit itself was done, and the board was given a written copy, Tony, at that time.
Hey.
Lee Tracy, Cedar City. What is the cost to the company, the Nevada company, does the Utah draws? How much of that $10 do they get, and how much do we keep?
Judy here. Judy, how much is our contract with Nevada? $2.something million. Somebody give me the exact number. Okay, it's about $2.5 million.
Yes.
In addition to that, the division has a great deal of expenses associated with the drawing. Our total costs of administering the drawing are closer to $10 than $5, hence the $10 application fee. I might also mention our drawing is much more complicated than the convention drawing.
Jason Lowe here in Salt Lake. Director Karpowitz, what's the percentage in comparison to that $10 if you were to break that down? You said that it was $5 for the expo, but it cost us more than $5 and relatively close to $10.
Yes.
You break that down in percentage?
Yeah, well, we have about 330,000 applications. It costs us about $2.5 million to contract with Nevada to do the drawing. In addition to that, we have full-time personnel that do nothing but work on drawing and licensing issues, a whole section of our agency that works on just drawing issues. And so our total costs of administering the drawing are closer to $10, and I can tell I didn't answer your question. What is it you want me to say?
Well, we'd like to know what the percentage would be. I'm not sure what I want you to say. I would just like to break it down so that we have a good idea of how much time is spent with that and what kind of percentage it is.
The percentage of the $10 application fee?
Yeah, roughly.
Well, like I say, we are much closer to $10 than $7. We've never added up our total costs of administering the regular drawing. But I asked Greg that question the other day, what are our total costs? And his response was, we are closer to 10 than 5. So we can, I mean, I don't know what the purpose would be into analyzing that. We have to administer the drawing, and we have to make sure it's done right. And we spend whatever we take to get it done right. And right now, those total costs are approaching $10 per application. Right. So that's 330,000 applications. That's $3.3 million.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation.
I'd like to just make a general comment. In terms of setting fees for the drawing, I think the same general approach is used as we do in setting all other fees, like license fees. So when you're going to make a request maybe once every 8 years for a license adjustment, you not only start with what's it costing us today, but what is the rate of increase that can be anticipated over the next 8 years. Because you got to kind of break even over that eight-year period. So typically, the agency will operate a little bit ahead in the first years and a little bit behind, eating up some of those extra amounts were there at the very beginning of the period.
That's correct, Ernie.
Hey. My name is DeLoss Christensen, Glenwood, Utah, representing myself. I'm still a little confused on the $10 fee that is paid to the people who run the regular draw process. My understanding is that that group receive revenue for doing that service. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is that a portion of that $10 fee,
yes,
or is that a
yes,
different amount?
Yes. Of the $10 fee generates on 330,000 applications about $3.3 million. Our contract with Nevada is roughly $2.5 million, and I'd appreciate it if someone from the division would go find that number for me.
So that organization then keeps somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million plus dollars.
Our contract with them is for $2.5 million.
And
the rest of the $10 application fee is used internally with the agency to work with the contractor and to deal with licensing and permitting issues associated with the drawing.
Could I just, Alan,
thank you for clarifying that, yeah, clarifying that, DeLoss.
Can I just clarify how it works, DeLoss, just real quick? Actually, all $10 comes back to us.
I see.
Nevada keeps not a penny. All of the money comes back to us, and then we pay them back the negotiated fee in the contract based on how many applications came
for the out. Effort that and
for,
the,
yeah, and
the
all
work
the other things they provide. But that's a contract that's actually it's issued every 5 years, but we go through an annual review process with them that's very arduous. I used to sit in, and it was horrible, so I don't do it anymore. but actually, all of the money, a lot of people think they keep the money and then send us a little bit of it back. That's not the way it works. It
okay.
all comes to the division.
All right. So they do receive revenue. Now, the question that I have then is, has anyone asked what that organization does with the revenue they receive? for example, has anyone asked to see their check register of what they spend their money for?
That's a very good question, and the answer is no. They are a contractor, and we pay them to provide certain services. In essence, the convention groups, by keeping the $5 application fee, they also become a contractor to conduct that portion of the drawing at the convention.
Now, I need to understand this maybe a little deeper then. So we have a public resource that generates revenue for an independent organization, and we don't ask what they do with their earnings. Is that correct?
You're talking about Nevada?
Yes.
That's correct, yeah.
And we think that's okay? That we don't mind or care what that group does with public money that's paid to them?
Only that we have to make sure they provide the services we've contracted with them to do.
Does that group ever do anything with wildlife conservation with their earnings?
No.
Do they give us money back to increase habitat or improve hunting or other wildlife species?
No.
No?
No, they're a computer company.
All right, thank you.
Ty Bolter. I got a breakdown, actually, from Greg, and my question is regarding the cost to administer the draw, or what we pay to the Nevada company. What I recall is it was just over $3 of that $10 goes to the Nevada company. I'm just wondering if that's accurate. That was the.
I don't know. I've asked for the number. Did anybody go find it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would probably be great for
I would
of
like
this.
To be able to report to everybody here what our contract is with Nevada. I understand it's around $2.5 million. If I'm wrong on that, we need to correct the record right now.
And then also, do the administrators of the expo actually do the draw, or do they pay someone to do the draw?
They administer the entire application and drawing procedure, and they do have contracts for part of that. Other parts of it, as I understand it, is done internally by the organizations, but they do have a contractor that does a portion of the work for them.
They do, and it showed on the expense report. So does that company put any money to wildlife that they pay to do the draw?
Not that
your
I'm
knowledge?
Aware of. Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
You mean the company that they contract with?
To do the draw, to administer the draw.
Not that I'm aware of. They're also a computer company.
Okay, thank you.
Jason Hawkins. Jim, I appreciated your presentation. I was wondering if you could just tell us just a little more about, you had some information there about the audit that's done of these monies generated from the convention permits. And I was curious what the audit consists of, and if the groups are segregating that money out, how do you audit it? In other words, is the money sitting in a separate pool that's segregated out and you're tracking that money and where it's spent, or is it a function of what projects have been funded? You know, because I guess I've heard that the money's in the general account for at least one of the groups. It's deposited there and kind of commingled.
Yeah.
And so I'm just trying to understand the audit. Is it segregated funds, or is it what projects have you guys funded in the last year that doesn't come from conservation permit monies?
It's the latter.
The latter. Okay.
We don't audit their actual expenditures on projects. They have reported those to the board in the past, and they're going to report it in more detail today for 2011 and 2012.
So the audit, or the numbers, the report, whatever we call it, what that really is it fair to say that that's a representation of projects funded during that year that did not come from conservation permit monies?
That's my understanding of what the groups have provided us in the past.
Let me clarify that the most of the audit is a performance audit, which is, are they following the rule? And so that's the main purpose of the audit. If you go into the rule and look at those six things that were on there, those are the things that the audit focuses on. So it goes in and looks. The other stuff is somewhat peripheral to what the purpose of the audit was. So to be clear, we don't do a financial audit.
No.
On the expo.
That's
and the
correct.
Funds in there. Okay. Also regarding the Nevada company that does the draw, do they receive any tags? So I think this is kind of a rhetorical question. So they don't receive tags. They're not beholden to any of that stuff. This is something you guys handle, and then they simply do the drawing.
No, and neither do these convention groups receive any tags.
Okay.
They are only allowed to conduct a portion of our big game drawing at the convention. They are not given tags, nor are they allowed to keep any of the public funds associated with those tags, permit fees, license fees, or any of that.
Right. It's simply the application fees for the opportunity.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Do we have any other questions? Okay, this is what I'm going to do. It's noontime. Stacy, are we ready? We're going to take a lunch break, and before we go to the next segment of this, we'll take lunch and we'll see those that are interested come back.
Yeah, well, there's only 4 comment cards if they're all groups. That's only 20 minutes. It's up to you. You're the chair. I don't know if there's a ton more comment cards hanging out there in the audience somewhere, but we...
Okay, let's do it.
We've got the public here, and some of them might want to leave after this.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm cutting it off of 6, guys.
Are they for agenda item number whatever we're on?
10.
These are not.
Okay, we'll take these so that we can, if you guys want to go, you can go after this. So the first one, Eric Dixon.
Mr. Chairman, other board members, my name's Eric Dixon. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Mueller Foundation. I am authorized by the Mueller Foundation Board of Directors to speak on behalf of and to conduct business for the Mueller Foundation. Let me first say that MDF is honored to play a role in Utah wildlife conservation. We consider it a privilege to work with the Division of Wildlife, other conservation groups, and the general public in our efforts to preserve our hunting heritage. In the spirit of transparency and accountability, the Mueller Foundation and Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife would like to voluntarily submit this report to the Wildlife Board, showing all revenue, direct expenses, and funding of conservation-related activities related to the 200 convention permits that are available by application through the Western Hunting Conservation Exposition. And I would like to add that as part of this report, the numbers that are reflected in those 2011 and 2012 numbers that you'll see on that, part of that report contains information that should be and could be considered proprietary. Since this process is an open application process for any conservation group to come and apply for these tags. So these are numbers that are directly associated as expenses with the administering of this drawing. MDF and SFW would like to ask the Wildlife Board to direct the Division of Wildlife to add a stipulation to the contract requiring that this annual report be supplied to the Wildlife Board on an annual basis. Now, if you look at the 2012 revenue and expenditure report, and I do have copies also that I've supplied to the general public over on this table if anybody wants to grab one. What we have done is that all of the revenue is stated first, the application fees. The expenses related only to the 200 tags is what is listed below there as expenses related only to the 200 tags, not entire expenses related to the expo, only the direct expenses related to the administering or the conducting of the drawing of the 200 tags. The remaining funds is what is considered to be available for conservation-related activities. And one of the things that I would like to point out is that the conservation-related activities, there's a true definition of what conservation activities would be. And let me just add that the majority of the time that I spend at my job at the Mule Deer Foundation would be considered conservation-related, not just on projects, but youth education, youth recruitment, dealing with agencies and other conservation groups, not necessarily on projects, but on conservation-related activities. So some of the expenses do include some administration, and I'll point that out. Now, this may or may not satisfy the requirements of some of the groups that are petitioning the board today. But what I would like to add is that, you know, we also have a section there, let's see, I may have to hustle this up a little bit, that talks about the benefits of the convention. And the reason that I've stated the benefits of the convention is because myself, Miles Moretti, I know that SFW and some other participants in this expo have felt personally attacked through some of the communication that has gone on, as well as the organizations. And the reason that we feel that way is because the intent, I believe, of the change in the rule is just not necessarily to call for transparency and accountability, but also with good information on email and the cloak of an admin or a login through public forums. I believe the true intent is to get rid of the convention and the expo tags altogether. And it wasn't until last night and this morning that I was told otherwise, but all the communication that I've seen in the past has been, you know, somewhat sinister. So with that in mind, I would like to ask the board to go ahead and accept this recommendation and direct the division to call this report mandatory. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Tony Abbott, representing himself.
Just a nobody, but appreciate the time. I am going to ask for a little latitude on time, and the only reason I'm going to do that, I'm one of the three people that actually created this. Other than Alan Clark, Mr. Bateman, and if Mr. Pay is still here, we put this thing together. And if I run out in 3 minutes, I would hope you'd give me a little latitude, because I think I'm privy to some information that a lot of people aren't, quite frankly. I appreciate Eric's comments, some of them. The ones about wanting to audit this thing. You can go through the records that Jim referred to, and unlike most people, Jim, I am absolutely clear on convention and conservation permits. I think you'll know that. And so I've never been misled or misunderstood as far as what I'm referring to. The audit is something that myself and Mr. Pay discussed at great length. In fact, the board, which one of them's here, Mr. Niemeyer at the time, had a great concern over these things. As you'll find through the minutes of the board records, if you go through all the recs, there were words that I used as the general manager of the Mule Deer Foundation, as one that created this, words like substantial, significant, accountability, transparency, and Mr. Bushman brought to my attention a lion's share. And so you can interpret those as you will, but those are words that I used as I traveled to every single RAC in this state several times pushing this through. So the intent of this program and the audience of this was to benefit wildlife. The expo is not in question. So Mr. Tixon mentioned there's a lot of people who want to get rid of the expo. On the record, Tony Abbott does not want to see the expo go away. Tony Abbott does not want to see the expo permits go away. What Tony Abbott wants to see is the accountability, which it sounds like they're finally coming to. And Mr. Karpowitz, to answer your question, 2 years ago before this rule came back up, and I can bring you guys several emails, I tried to get an accountability from both groups, sent to Mr. Bateman, sent to Mr. Moretti's, sent to Mr. Payne. None of them responded to me. Mr. Tixon actually called me a couple weeks before the rule came back up. In my opinion, appeased me for a while until the new rule went into place. Again, that's my word, but that's what's happened. So there has been a great concern over this. I've talked with Jim about this at great lengths, and this is not open and shut. In other words, the expo needs to be transparent. The funds raised off the general public need to be transparent, and the money needs to be put on the ground for wildlife. I need to apologize to you and everyone in this room. We wouldn't have this discussion right now today if I had stood up for what I tried to stand up for 6 or 7 years ago when I said we need to run this like the conservation permits. I didn't. I backed down, and it's my fault now that we're sitting here having this discussion because I didn't stand on the principles that I thought needed to be there. I know I'm out of time. If there's any questions, Mr. Brady, I'd be happy to answer them.
I don't think so. Thank you, Tony. We could get back to you.
Thank you.
Jason Hawkins.
Hawkins, I'm here representing myself as a lifelong resident and sportsman here in the state of Utah. I've been following this issue of the convention permit for probably 4 years now, and during that time I've had a chance to talk to many of the groups, the individuals involved, the leaders of those groups, and had a fair amount of dialogue on this. We've asked over and over. I guess I should make it clear, I'm here primarily to discuss and comment on item 12, which is the UWC's proposed rule amendment that's coming up probably shortly after lunch. What that's asking for is transparency and accountability with regard to the convention permits. We've been asking for that for years with these groups. I've met with both the groups that are involved. I've met with their leaders. I've talked to them on the phone. I've had dialogue with them via email, and we've been repeatedly told no, that it's not required by the rule to provide that information. Now that we have a proposed rule amendment before the Wildlife Board, we come to the meeting today, and as part of item number 10, we have this proposal between the DWR and the two groups to have this annual report, an audit, whatever you want to call it, voluntarily produced by the groups. And I don't think the timing of this is a coincidence. Obviously, they're addressing the concern that's being raised and the fact that there's an alternative out there right now, this item 12 and this proposed rule amendment. And I would respectfully ask the board, before you make a decision on that annual report, whether it's a rule change or a stipulation or whatever it might be, that you hold off and hear item number 12, the UWC's proposed rule amendment. So much time and effort has gone to get that before the board, and I think it would be a shame to be cut out at the last minute and have that mooted or limited or minimized by this requirement or this stipulation that they're asking for now to address that. The second thing I'd just like to add, and I'll echo what Mr. Abbott said, we're not here. I can't speak for any person, but the majority of the people I've spoken to, we're not here to kill the expo, to take away the tags, to get rid of the expo. We're asking for accountability and transparency with public assets, these 200 convention permits. I've made that clear. I heard what Mr. Tixon said. I met with Mr. Tixon and Mr. Moretti over a year ago in their office. I told them I enjoyed the expo. I generally apply every year. I drew a tag there 1 year. And I don't want to see that go away, but I don't believe those permits are fulfilling their statutory purpose. We've dropped the ball on accountability and transparency. I've also spoken to Mr. Tixon in the last couple of weeks about this and told him this isn't about getting rid of those tags. And so he's known about this before last night. I think that's very clear. Once again, there may be some people here that want to get rid of the expo, but my guess is that's a very slim minority of the people. And I'll save the remainder of my comments when we get to item 12. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I Boulder.
How you doing? Ty Bolter, UWC. I'd like to display my gratitude for MDF coming up and proposing that they have a yearly accounting and say that the UWC supports that. In regards to our group and others associated with us, the comments made that we want the expo and those tags to go away, that's simply not true. I believe that's a red herring thrown out there to steer the course away from the true issue here, which is transparency. We need to know where the funds are going, and this has nothing to do with the expo or the tags, only the funds associated with them.
Regarding the project expenses on this sheet that they've provided, we have no way to ascertain that these projects were funded directly from the proceeds of the expo. It's not in a separate account. It's, I mean, it's on the sheet, and I appreciate that, but we don't know. There's no way to decipher whether this is, you know, other expenses that are for other things smashed into this for accounting purposes. You know, a 990 tax form, I'm a businessman. You put that together, and it can look a lot of ways depending what your end goal is. Also, on the expenditure sheet under expenses related to the expo, only the 200 tags. Again, there's no details to clarify if these are specific to the funds from those tags, or the applications, excuse me. And then we need details to ascertain the validity of these expenses as well. I mean, if they've got administration in there as a cost for example, $184,800, there's no way for us to know if that admin is also paying for things that are pertinent to the expo itself, not the application fee. So I'd say we need to look into that a little more deeply, and if we are going to have a yearly accounting, it needs to be very detailed and verified and hold up to scrutiny. Thank you.
Last one, Byron Bateman. Can you fill out a card for us, Bill?
Here's
okay.
So you're not going to comment on 11, Bill?
Byron Bateman, president of SFW. I marked 10, 11, and 12.
Yeah, you did.
I'm really not sure which one of those comments can be appropriate for. But what Jim gave in his presentation, I think, answered a lot of questions that the public has had. We are a service provider, just like Fallon, Nevada, for the 200 permits. We are compliant 110% to the current contract that we have with the state of Utah. Mule Deer Foundation is our contract partner with the state of Utah. The audit information we just presented, like I said, is 110% compliant to the contract. What everybody else is talking about is how we should spend the money that we earned at the expo by providing a service, which is another drawing for the state of Utah. The drawings run concurrent. The state drawing for everybody runs concurrent at the same time that we're doing our drawing at the expo. Jim gave you the figures. We've more than exceeded the minimum expectations. We had no idea going in when we started this. Like Tony mentioned, there's not very many of us left that were originally in this whole thing to get the whole thing off the ground and get it going. We put up a lot of money. If any of you have ever started a business, you've got to come up with your capital and take a risk. We took a great risk back in 2007, actually in 2005 and 2006, committing to do an expo in the state of Utah to help benefit the wildlife in the state of Utah. We've created hundreds of jobs for citizens of the state of Utah. We've generated millions of dollars for wildlife. We've generated millions of dollars for the city of Salt Lake. How do you define what is for wildlife? I get a call to drive to Paiute County to meet with the county sheriff to try and resolve a conflict with deer and elk depredation. It's not on that list that we presented. We get a call from law enforcement that we need some extra support. Could you get your people to contact a county prosecutor? We want to make sure that this poacher is punished justly for what he's done. That's not in that cost sheet that's done. We do that. I get a call, can you get a cashier's check and go out and buy this critical piece of habitat and be at the courthouse in Duchesne County at 9 a.m., a bank sale, a piece of property that's landlocked by, you know, one of our WMAs? That's not represented anywhere on that sheet of what our expenses are. What we've done for the great state of Utah and the great hunters of the state of Utah, because we're all part of a family, and you see in that list of expenses, We do a lot for family. We do a lot for military. That's part of what we do. We put on a great show. You ask the people that come there now. If you look at the list, I said there's people came from 35 states. These are just the non-residents that applied. 35 states came to Utah. We're bringing people to Utah. That's part of what the expo was intended to do. We're doing an awesome job. There's five people from foreign countries that came and applied for tags. If they draw that tag, they've got to come back and hunt in the fall. That means they've got to spend more money in the state of Utah. What these people are talking about is the money we raise by providing a service, they want 100% of it to go back to wildlife. We do too. But we have costs just like the state does. Our costs are a lot lower than what Jim alluded to. Based on the revenue that's generated, $3.3 million, 75% of that goes back to Fallon, Nevada. And I hope your number is right, Jim, because I just did the math based on that number. But it's a major controversy, and like Eric just had a little bit of time alluded to, but we've been under attack. There are people that want to take this expo away from us. Believe me, there's a lot of people that will lose. Wildlife will lose. The citizens of the state of Utah will lose, and we'll all lose. We need to stand behind the expo and support it, and we need to get a return on our investment that we put into this thing to get it going and get it off the ground. And I guarantee you that you're going to see this continued report that we've put out. SFW has been doing it. If you come to one of our banquets and you pick up our program, you read the auction catalog, you'll see a list of items that we do every year. It's on our website. Transparency is only as transparent as you want it to be. And believe me, it's transparent when it comes to SFW and the Mule Deer Foundation. Like I say, I've got two more cards. I can talk about this a little bit more. But
let's have you come back.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to finish this and go to lunch, Byron, but we'll have you come up back.
Appreciate
with other
it. Thank
items.
You.
Thank you. Bill?
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman. I'll be quick. I want to compliment the Division of Wildlife and the Wildlife Board for the way they've handled the convention permit process. I want to compliment Eric did a good job and the Mule Deer Foundation of explaining what's gone on. No rules have been broken. That's a fact. Now for just a minute, so we can get off to lunch, I'm going to get on my soapbox. A couple of months ago, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation issued a press release about transparency in the use of public hunting permits. This wasn't geared towards Utah directly. It was geared towards multiple states in the West where there's been attempts to circumvent programs that have been in place with public permits. It's been erroneous at some groups. After this press release came out, and individuals took exception with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and for our call to transparency. That I don't understand. There is no reason for any group or individual to take offense at increasing their transparency. And the Elk Foundation will always be transparent and will continue to be so to our members, volunteers, and the public at large. Asking for more transparency is not wrong. It's right. Now, there's been no problem with the convention permit program, and I compliment the Division of Wildlife for making recommendations and Eric and the Mule Deer Foundation for making recommendations to increase the auditing and reporting and accountability portion of the contract. That's right. It's the right thing to do. I'm not going to get involved, and nor did I get involved in public blogs and things discussing issues with different people with different beliefs. The Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation supports the conservation program, permit program, and the Elk Foundation supports the convention permit program with the addition of the increased transparency and reporting auditing. If there's any question as to whether the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation is out to close down the Hunt Expo or attack any other group directly, it's wrong. And if anybody has issues with that, they can contact me directly. We do ask for transparency not only from our public agencies, but also from our brother and sister conservation groups. It's imperative that people know where their money's going, and we will always be involved in that and we'll always lead the charge in that. Thank you very much. Let's go to lunch.
Thank you, Bill. Let's go to lunch. We'll dismiss and we'll finish this. Hope everybody's having fun.